You're listening to The Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, otherwise known as The Lamb. The Lamb is the world's biggest collection of online movie blogs, and every week on this show we invite various Lamb members on to talk about pretty much everything in our movie-loving worlds. Find The Lambcast at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello everybody, and welcome to episode 493 of the Lambcast. I'm your host, Jake Lewitt, that podcaster, that English podcaster from England, and from Life vs. Film. And this week we're continuing our prolonged coverage of the James Bond franchise by tackling films 9 through 12 in the series, all of which star Roger Moore, but only one of them has a pigeon doing a double take. So, join me today we have my co-host from Kirkham Movie Day and the Catching Up podcast. Nobody does it better. Nobody does it half as good as him. It's Richard Kirkham.
The Chinese have a saying, before setting out to do a 007 podcast, clear at least 3 hours.
Yeah, I didn't check that before the show. I hope none of you have anywhere to be today. This could take a while. Also joining us from Almost Ginger, she's better than a computer in all sorts of ways. It's Rebecca Sharp.
Your powers of observation do you credit, Mr. Bond?
A woman? Also joining us from the Code of Zeke and out now with Aaron Abe. He has a powerful weapon. He charges a million a shot. It's Aaron Newirth.
I've put in my very strong teeth and I'm ready to bite a piece off this podcast.
Don't bite through your microphone. You need that. And finally, we have a newcomer from Stardust and Shadows and Nitrate Visions. He never showers without a gun. It's Terry Sherwood.
Mrs. Peel were needed. Oh, sorry, that's the wrong franchise. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me on.
Hi, welcome to the show. Terry, as always with newcomers, would you like to take a moment to say a little bit about yourself and your site? Sites plural, I suppose.
All right. My first site is actually Stardust and Shadows, which deals with classic Hollywood. We're dealing with silent film all the way up through probably to the 40s and 50s. We chat up on film noir. We chat up on juvenile films, exploitation films. We basically cover the entire gambit of silliness. Mostly, it's pictures that I enjoy because I am Canadian. What I try to do is I try to emphasize the Canadian contributions in the golden age of Hollywood. The second site is purely a horror site. Nitrate Visions, again, deals with the horror media. We have interviews with independent filmmakers. We cover film reviews, film books, conventions. We try to cover everything, even comics. So it's something that is a great interest of mine. Happened when I was a youngin, grew up on Hammer Films, Amicus. And it's something that is of great interest to me and something that I think I impart a unique voice to.
Very nice. So your first site, Stardust and Shadows, you say you focus a lot on Canada and its contribution to film. How do you feel that Bond has yet to go to Canada?
Actually, there is a Canadian connection to Bond. There's a Canadian actor in, I believe it was Goldfinger. There is a scene where he's playing cards. Auric Goldfinger is playing cards. And the actor in the scene with Gert Frobe is a Canadian actor. The name escapes me right now.
That's not a strong connection.
And also, Dr. No. The actor who played Dr. No, Joseph Wiseman, was a Canadian by birth.
But do you feel like he'll get to Canada at any point as a franchise?
He might be, you know.
Can I add something? The opening of Spy Who Loved Me was filmed in Canada.
Really? Mm-hmm. Okay.
On Baffin Island.
but it's set in Austria.
Well, it's set in, but yeah,
I'm just confirming. But it's set in Austria, goddamn.
That's kidding.
You know, like First Blood is shot in Canada, but it's set in not Canada.
Yeah. We're looking for whatever connections we can find, Jay. Don't be so picky.
Not trying to be picky, just fine. No. Okay.
It'd be interesting if he did. You know, he could. You know, you can do this. There's plenty of skiing here and everything. And mind you, that's been done in Bond Pictures before.
Has it? Okay, very nice. Well, welcome to the show, Terry. Now, we have one more bit of business for you to do as a newcomer. As always on this show, we ask a new guest every week to rank what is the objectively greatest film franchise of all time. So, Terry, it doesn't really fit into either of your categories of, like, classic horror or classic cinema. But the Jurassic Park franchise, please could you rank them for me in order of your favorite?
In order of my favorite, this is in any film we're doing, or we're doing a Bond film?
This is the five Jurassic Park films.
Oh, gosh. Welcome to Jurassic Park. I will have to say the first one.
Good.
Only the first one. The scene that reflects right for me is, of course, the outhouse scene. Laura Dern, I thought was quite good. Anything else suffers from sequelitis, I'm going to say. So there's only one.
So
that's the first one.
Have you seen all of the sequels?
I've seen the first two. After that, the first one I saw in the theater. The second one I saw on a Blu-ray. So I'll have to say it's still the first one. Very close to the book, but no, there's only one, and it is the first one.
So you're choosing not to rank the other films in the franchise?
No, I'm not, because I'm not a huge fan of sequels.
That's fine. Okay, you're talking about the wrong franchise.
We are on the series.
I'm a huge fan of. There's a difference between a sequel and a series, though.
Yeah.
And what I will say is that I'm not a huge fan of sequels, usually because unless there's something new to say, then they don't work.
Okay, fair enough. Well, you've got the first Jurassic Park in the right place. Everything else doesn't really matter. So that'll do. So let's get on and talk about the Bond franchise, shall we? So today we are talking about The Man with the Golden Gun, The Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, and A Few Eyes Only, so we're going through the 70s and just dipping our toes into the 80s with these. 81. So before we dig into it, I kind of liked what Richard did on the last Bond franchise show, where we didn't go film by film, we kind of went topic by topic. Mm. And we kind of compared and contrasted various aspects of different Bond films. So in that segment, we had three different Bonds, three different Blofelds, so it kind of worked nicely. But we're going to do the same thing here. So we're going to talk about the Bonds, or the Bond in this case, then the women, the villains, the secondary characters, the music, the gadgets, the set pieces, the plots, and then our final scores at the end. Any final thoughts that didn't really fit into any of those categories. But to start with, I'm interested to know a little bit of history from our guests, their histories with the Bond franchise. So Aaron, you were on for the Spy Who Loved Me's movie of the month. You're the kind of the champion of that film. So listeners already know a little bit about your history of the franchise. But if you wouldn't mind filling us in a little bit again, why do you like these films? Why did you want to be on this show in particular? What's your history with the franchise?
I assume all listeners recall every single episode 492 beforehand, so I mean, I don't have to go too far back, but I mean, yes, I was on for the Spy Who Loved Me movie of the month episode. Spy Who Loved Me is one of my favorite movies of all time, and it's also one of my favorite, I mean, by default, it's one of my favorite Bond movies. So with that, I think probably what I spoke about at that time is that Roger Moore, I'm a fan of his series of Bond films. I'm not going to say all of them, including at least one of them for this episode, but his take on Bond to me, it's not, I mean, Sean Connery is my favorite Bond, but Roger Moore, for whatever reason, and I grew up in the Brosnan era, but like seeing like the Bond marathons on TV or whatnot, Roger Moore was one I always kind of responded to, as far as it's just a pure fun, pure exercise and fun. There's something about his his delivery of this kind of performance where he plays this Dean Martin version of Bond that I just kind of respond to. And so with particularly this set of films that we're going to talk about, you kind of see an escalation in what the James Bond films are doing as far as getting bigger and bigger and bigger before they go back down a bit again. So it's, there's something about that that I really like as far as seeing the Bond formula in action and seeing what lengths it goes to. With the series in general, it comes in stages. There's things that I like about the ones that try to go big. There's things I like about some of the ones that try to play things a little grittier. I'm an admirer of this franchise. I don't disapprove of this franchise when it kind of goes into goofy area, just because I think that's kind of inherent when it comes to James Bond.
Yeah, and we will be getting into goofy area later in the show. I'm kind of annoyed that we're doing a franchise and we're not just doing a show on Moonraker. If I'm honest with you, I feel like that could be a 2-hour discussion all on its own. But more on that later.
I'll be happy to talk about Moonraker and what works about it.
I had a good time watching that last night. It's not a good film, but I had a good time.
It's a good film.
So, Terry, what's your history with the franchise?
For James Bond, let me see. I will have to say slightly the reverse of what we just heard. I'm not a huge fan of Roger Moore's interpretation of the Bond character. He was too light. Excuse me. He relied on, yes, there was a certain Dean Martin. That was a good analogy, actually. I'm a big Rat Pack fan. He was a Dean Martin style, fellow. In some ways, frivolous. I wish he was a little bit more like Simon Templar, a little bit more harder edged. I am a huge, huge, if you got to go farther back, I was a huge, huge Sean Connery person. I still am. Why? Because Bond is a man. He's a man's man. He looked like Hoagy Carmichael from the books. Sean Connery was extremely tough. The expressions that he used, the low-key humor that he used, often the quips and everything added an edge. Also, most of these films are products of their time. Sean Connery was a product of the swinging 60s. We have Roger Moore, Pierce Brosnan and everything crossing over into the 70s and the 80s. And yes, there was a lightness to them. The plots for most of the Roger Moore films became a little bit derivative. There's a little bit too much emphasis on comedy. I'm going to mention about that Southern Sheriff that keeps showing up in a couple of them. Okay, we're a little bit pandering to the American audience. We're trying to do the Smokey and the Bandit shtick. The every which way but loose type thing that was going on at the time, the folksy humor, that's fine. That's wonderful. But no, it didn't really grab me. I found them light. Again, I'm going to go right back to Sean. These Roger Moore pictures are interesting. I think what is better are some of the surrounding people, the supporting actors that they have in them. Particularly Christopher Lee was brilliant. But a lot of the other plots and everything, no, they don't grab me that much.
Okay, that's all fair enough. Well, I'm sure we'll dig into all of that a little bit deeper later. Rebecca, you're less well-versed in Bond, I believe. What's your history with the franchise?
Yes, don't really have much of a history. Obviously living in England and are constantly on TV.
How?
they are constantly on TV. So I've caught like scenes, bits and bobs of little bits of information, things like that. My mum likes them, as many parents of the 60s and 70s do. And yeah, I'd only really seen the Craigs and maybe a couple of the Pierce Brosnans and You Only Live Twice randomly. No idea why I've seen that before. So yeah, I completely rewatched all of the, well, not rewatched, watched the first time all of the Bond films, including obviously what we're going to talk about today. So at least I had some bit of context. But no, I really don't have any kind of history with the Bond films. Apart from the fact that I'd always heard that the Roger Moore ones were a bit cheesier. And actually, the Roger Moore ones were always the ones on TV as well that I'd heard, yeah, that I'd watched a little bit of as well, maybe. Bits and pieces here and there. But no, I really don't. Just what you hear, just the cheesy lines, you know, that people say about the Bond films, I really didn't have much of a history, really. So, yeah.
But you wanted to be on this batch specifically because of the Man with the Golden Gun.
Oh shit! Yeah, I have. Yeah, of course. Sorry, I totally forgot about that.
Sorry.
and I mean, I have seen the Man with the Golden Gun. I've seen it many times.
Yes, I was gonna say, this isn't what you said last week.
I'm really glad you're here, Jay. yeah, I've seen the Man with the Golden Gun probably about 5 times. Yes. I'd seen it about 3 times. I saw it a couple of times before I went to Thailand, because I've visited what is now known as James Bond Island in Thailand. It's Scaramanga's Island in The Man with the Golden Gun. So I'd watched it a couple of times before that, and I watched it one time after that as well, just to kind of, yeah, because of what I do. I like watching films about the places that I'm about to go to, and I thought it'd be a nice one to visit. So I have, yes, sorry, forgot about that. I'm glad you're here to remind me of things.
I have my uses.
Usually I like to tell people all the time that I've been to this place in Thailand, so it's incredible that I didn't start off talking about that, because usually you can't shut me up about it. Yeah, so that's a bit of an anomaly with the whole James Bond thing. So that is the film that I've seen the most by far, Man with the Golden Gun, yes.
Okay. Richard, yeah, you and I have already discussed this twice now, but just a little refresher, or just more specifically, your history with these 4 films.
Well, obviously, Roger Moore was an important part of my growing up. I came to Bond earlier, but the Roger Moore films dominated the 1970s, and that's my primary time period of film development. So they were a critical part of my enjoyment of the film series. I don't think Roger Moore is the best James Bond, but his films are very entertaining, and I think it was Terry who said it earlier, they are a reflection of the times and the kinds of films, exactly, that were being made at that point. And this is definitely where Roger Moore fits in best. I think that, you know, not only his age suggested that he needed to move on, that was part of it, but also just the style and the kinds of films that we were getting needed to develop, and that's probably one of the reasons that it was appropriate for him to leave when he did. Maybe a little late, but we'll see.
Yes, and with me, I haven't made it a secret that before this little project, Roger Moore was my least favorite Bond, because of a lot of the reasons that Terry said, where he's kind of too light, he's too light-hearted. And all I could recall, the last time I watched all these films, I watched them like all at that point 23, I think 22, 23. I watched them all in the space of a couple of weeks, and just by the time I got to the end of the Roger Moore segment, I wanted to burn them all. I wanted to stop and set fire to them all and never watch them again, just because it got a bit too much. Watching 7, well, would have been like 14 and a half hours of Roger Moore in quick succession was a little bit too much. And then we watched Live and Let Die on the last batch, and I really liked him in that. I thought he was really good, and now I'm starting to remember why I didn't like him after these 4, because he's kind of edging towards that territory of, I've kind of had enough of you. So this is going to bring us nicely into the first sort of conversation, which is Roger Moore as Bond. So last time we had 3 different Bonds, this time we just have one. We have Roger Moore, who gets progressively older as the films go through, but also seems to get quite a lot older as the films carry on going. Richard mentioned his age. I think he is too old from second one of film one to be playing James Bond. In every action sequence that he is in, I just feel sorry for him, because there's these young, athletic people beating up an old man. And it just... I just don't like watching it. So even like aside from the age differences with his female counterparts, and how kind of icky that is at times, more on that later. I shouldn't be feeling sorry for Bond, and I do, and I can't. That's the only note I have about Roger Moore is he's too old.
Well, I actually think he works pretty well in a couple of the fight scenes that he does in the series that we're looking at here. I like the fight scene on top of the apartment in The Spy Who Loved Me. And I think that I was watching the Moonraker last night, and the scene in the Venetian glass factory was also pretty good. I would never say he was a martial artist, and I certainly wouldn't say he was a tough guy, but he could move parts of his body pretty effectively, and of course...
Mainly an eyebrow.
Yeah. Well, the nice part about it was, you know, he's got the right attitude. One of my favorite shots from the later James Bond films, the Daniel Craig films, is when Craig is, you know, straightening out his cufflinks after jumping off of steamroller onto the train.
That's best Bond moment of all the films. That's my favorite seconds of Bond.
And that's a very Roger Moore type of
thing. And that's a very Roger Moore kind of thing. Roger Moore straightens his tie, he brushes off his lapel, he, you know, pulls down the cuff on his shirt through the jacket. He does that after all of those fight sequences really well, and he has aplomb, and he is a little bit aloof in those situations. I don't think that it's really meant to be very gritty. It's meant to be a fantasy, and I thought he fit fine into the fantasy. I didn't think he seemed overmatched in too many of those sequences, except, of course, when he's fighting Jaws, and, you know, Jaws looks
and he loses
three times
most of the time.
Size.
I mean, yeah. if you want to talk specifically about fight sequences and his adeptness to be involved in them. What I would say about, especially these first, the specific batch of films we're talking, he's not put into too many challenges. It's not Casino Royale. Like, he's not put into these, like, you know, beat down brawls that have multiple adversaries against him in, like, perilous scenarios. Like, he's generally fighting, like, one, maybe two people using judo against people that are also using, like, some rudimentary form of judo. Like, he's not put to the task in the same way that Connery was in some of his films, or Craig was, or obviously Dalton and Brosnan, since those movies, I mean, that's the 80s and 90s where it's getting, the action is becoming more of a prevalent force in how you want to show off these heroes. These films, I think it matches the tone as far as what kind of scuffles he's getting into. I would say, as far as age goes, I would say I disagree, Jay, as far as him already feeling old. I think when we get to For Your Eyes Only, when I thought
he runs up 250 steps, and at the top of it,
That's when it really sticks out to me is him being, okay, I get that everyone seems to, because this is the case too, he was Bond this long because everyone liked him as Bond at the time. Like, the opinion turned, like, there's obviously, yes, there are people that prefer Connery, but he wasn't Bond for seven movies because nobody liked him. Like, he was incredibly popular as James Bond. And by the time you get to the 80s, I mean, yeah, he's push it up there while everyone around him is not as, you know, not as old as him and what have you. So it shows. And I would say the next batch of movies you do, that's more reflective of a guy that's too old to play this character than the films we're currently talking about.
It could also, like, my dislike could be he's my dad's Bond and I'm just rebelling against my dad. I don't know. What about Rebecca, Terry? What are your thoughts on Roger Moore?
I didn't really get the age thing because I can't even believe that Sean Connery was 32 in Dr. No. Like, he looks so much older. So I don't know if it's, you know, people used to smoke more back then or whatever. I'm not sure. But
well, in For Your Eyes Only, Roger Moore is 54.
Oh, I thought he was younger than that.
I think he looks older. Okay.
All right. Okay. So the age thing doesn't really apply to me because I feel like they both kind of, I don't know. And I also kind of think that when I did watch the fight scenes, I remember specifically, was it Moonraker? He's on a plane?
Yes.
Is that right?
There's a fight on the plane.
At the opening of Moonraker.
Yes,
that one. And he gets into a bit of a fight. I remember that feeling a little bit disjointed because obviously I've literally just these past couple of weeks watched them from like Connery through to Roger Moore. And it's kind of weird that they're having a fight scene because I, to me, just from watching these films, it's like, that's not what he's really about. He's kind of like this suave, like, old British secret agent. Like, he doesn't do fights, like that kind of thing. I guess this is why we're getting, like, maybe that's how, like, the tone of the film is developing with the times. But it seems really disjointed to me to see him, like, getting to these fights. It's like, oh my god, haven't you got, like, all of these weapons that you could, like, do something with? You know, guns and things coming out of your watch, and, you know, that's what they're for, clearly, and knives coming out of shoes, and that kind of, like, quirky, techie side of things. And when I see him get into, like, fights and he's, like, you know, suit and tie and whatever, that kind of thing, that just seems really, that, I don't know, that kind of takes me out of it a little bit. So I'm not really here for the fights. Obviously, as the films do kind of progress, I think that makes a little bit more sense, but maybe that is because I still kind of see him more with, like, the Sean Connery style of film. Like, to me, the films haven't really changed that much in, like, style and tone, really. The budgets have gotten bigger, but, like, the tone to me is quite similar. So, Roger Moore, I mean, he's definitely the worst Bond for me. I don't like him at all. But maybe that's just because I'm watching them now. I don't know. I thought Sean Connery was better. I thought the Australian model I can't remember.
Lazenby,
yes. I thought he was much better. I would have liked to have seen him do more films.
That's an uncommon opinion, but I don't disagree with it. I liked him.
Yeah, but just comparing him just to Roger Moore, I don't know, I liked him. And actually going back to when Roger Moore went to Tracy Bond's grave at the start of For Your Eyes Only, I was like, I just can't really see him ever getting married, because he's just so creepy and, like, icky. Like, he's so icky. Like, and that's kind of how that Bond has gone. But it's like, I can't imagine that Bond being like the Lazenby kind of Bond. I don't know. So yeah, I was just like, ugh, no, I just couldn't picture it.
Can you imagine him being the kind of guy who would quote himself on his own wife's gravestone as a beloved wife of James Bond? That needs to be on there.
Yeah, I could probably see him doing that, yeah. But I don't know, that kind of brought me out of it, being like, oh yeah, no, he's a very different kind of Bond to how Lazenby was. I'm not quite sure about Sean Connery, maybe he was more similar to Sean Connery, but I don't know why I'm comparing them. But yeah, it's probably because so far he is the worst Bond for me. I just don't have any kind of, I do find him too creepy.
You've said creepy a couple of times. What is it that is creepy about him?
Oh, icky. Maybe I mean icky. Maybe not creepy, but just lechy. Just like, especially, probably because in For Your Eyes Only, he probably doesn't do anything with, but it's kind of suggestible towards the young skater. That's disgusting.
Well, I feel in that sense, he's not the icky one. He's like, yeah, rebuffing her advances. She's the one.
But maybe not against the character of Bond, maybe against the film.
Okay.
Maybe not, like, I don't know. I just don't like it.
Well, do you intend to continue watching the rest of these films? Because it's only going to get worse.
But he's not in them films.
Yeah, you've got two more where it's going to get worse.
Well, that's okay. Live and Let Die has been my least favourite film thus far, and I continued watching after that. So
okay, yeah. Fair enough.
I don't know. It's really hard for me to give. Like, I'm kind of. It's becoming very apparent to me my lack of knowledge with these films is, like, I can only really speak to the films that I've watched over, like, the past 2 weeks, and I don't know any, like, more knowledge than that, essentially, than what I've watched, and I just kind of have, like, a gut reaction, and my gut reaction is Roger Moore not as good as the other two Bonds, and not a massive fan of how the film kind of presents him with the dialogue and stuff.
Okay. Acting wise, I think he does a pretty good job at some points, like, outside of the kind of the fighting, the action. So he has some, in The Man with the Golden Gun, when he's, like, walking down the street and the guy gets shot next to him, like, I genuinely believe he's terrified at that point.
You mentioned Man with the Golden Gun, where I think that's his worst of this set of films we're talking. Like, I think he just feels out of it for some, like, that movie in particular, everyone seemed to hate working on, like, based on everything I've read about it, like, everyone, it kind of shows watching it again, where Live and Let Die, for his first time, he just seemed like, yeah, he's game to do this. For some reason, the second film, he just seems like kind of there. But then, for me, he feels in the pocket for Spy Love Me and Moonraker, and even for Your Eyes Only. Like, he feels like he's just, like, happy to be there. He wants to be doing this stuff. He feels engaged with the material. He's having the quips. It even has some edge in some of these, in some of the aspects of those films. But, like, there's, I do think there's a variety of the performances he gives in some of these, and I do think this kind of that middle section of movies, he's just like game for all of it.
I have a general question I'll throw out before I throw my comments in. Did Roger Moore ever smoke in a James Bond film?
Yeah, he does cigars.
Yeah, he did cigars. James Bond, I believe he had those hand rolled Chesterfields. I think they were. Was from the books and such. Did he smoke all the way through the series, or in these four films that we're talking about and everything?
No, it kind of comes.
So that's an interesting thing, because smoking became even more evil in the 70s, and we were all on that fitness kick, you know, which makes another case for him being products of the time.
If you look at Living Daylights with Timothy Dalton, he's like they do a lot away with his promiscuity because of the HIV outbreak. I mean, they try to temper the things that he's known for throughout this series, as well as advance some of them as well.
Every Bond film is a kind of reaction to the time. Moonraker comes out just after Star Wars, and he goes to space.
The Golden Gun is in response to martial arts films. Exactly. The Live and Let Die is in response to blaxploitation. All of the 60s films are in response to Hitchcock movies. I mean, that's always Bond.
One-on-ones are in response to Bourne. Yeah, it's all whatever's popular in other films. That's what the Bourne franchise is.
I just noticed, by the way, that there was smoking on the submarine.
Of course. Why wouldn't that be?
That's when they still have the screen doors involved.
Was there smoking in space?
So did, as far as my take on Roger, he is my least favorite Bond. I think I prefaced it before by saying, I grew up with the Sean Connerys. I pretty much, this may be aging myself, but I saw a lot of those in the theater, which make it sort of a different experience, when they first came out, except for Dr. No, which my parents wouldn't let me go and see for some reason. Roger wears the clothes well. That's all I can say. He has sort of a debonair quality of it. He was very lighthearted. The country gentleman type, quips that he did. I found his James Bond was more passive. He is acted upon. He doesn't initiate action. And after all, is not James Bond a, quote, man of action type thing? Again, I'm going to go back to the literary sections. He's a doer. He's not a watcher.
He's also described as a blunt instrument. Not in these films, but elsewhere. So he's at the end of it, he's a tool of the government. So he's there to do a job.
Like, Rebecca just sees him as a tool.
I want to say, I've been trying to make these shows like a celebration of the Bond franchise, trying to find people that like genuinely like the films that I want to talk about. It wasn't my intention that 60% of today's show hate Roger Moore.
I don't hate him. Like, I really, really love The Spy Who Loved Me. And I can't have really loved it without having also liked the actors who was in it. Maybe just as like a general overview, he's not my favorite at all.
I apologize for putting words in your mouth.
I mean, I would say that he has, to me, some of at least one of the best Bond movies, but also three of the worst. So it's like as much as I'm happy to praise Roger Moore, I'm not
on this show.
It's not like he's faultless, but I don't think it has to do with what Roger Moore is doing as an actor. I think he's doing what's required of him, and he's doing what's clearly worked best for these films at the time. Does that always make for a great film? No, it doesn't. I mean, that's just how it is sometimes, especially when you have various problems with what you want to do with your story or how you're responding to the time or what have you. But I mean, Moore as an actor, he's doing what's required of him.
Yeah, how much of it do you think is falls upon the producer and the directors and everything? You know,
I think that the Broccoli's and you know, at the time, especially early on when they're shifting from Connery, they're like asking a lot of this person to take an iconic role and make it his own. And so he's, it feels like Live and Let Die, which we're not talking about specifically, but that and Man with the Golden Gun, those are movies that were designed with Connery in mind. Like the initial stages had him like still being involved. And so you have this weird amalgamation of Roger Moore trying to find the character and also him trying to kind of remind you of Connery, but not. So like you have certain attitudes he takes, especially like Man with the Golden Gun. He beats a woman at one point. He's very rude and like it's the that movie's the most un Roger Moore of the movies for his performance. It feels he's a lot
designed bumbled. For Sean Connery, so he must beat a woman.
He's a colder character.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you also have him trying to differentiate himself by having the cigar, like we mentioned, drinking what brandy instead of a vodka martini, using a Magnum in Live and Let Die instead of his PPK. I mean, it's a weird mix of like trying to get him to, which is why, again, I think Spy Who Loved Me seems like they cleared it all out. They had more time because they had a couple years in between. Like Man with the Golden Gun almost killed the franchise. Like it literally, like everyone was disappointed by it. Like it stopped them cold as far as making one year after another. So like when they got to that one, they had some more time. They got Guy Hamilton out of there and they brought in what Lewis Gilbert to give kind of a fresh take directorially. So it's like everything kind of reset itself and just felt clear as far as the trajectory of these movies.
Yeah. Didn't they lose one of their producers, that Harry Saltzman or something like that?
Yes. And, yes. After, they yeah. split after Golden Gun. Yeah.
Yeah. And that changed. Well, when you bring in new people, you're going to get new blood, so to speak, and mm-hmm. and you have to try different things. And I think when you mentioned about the cigar and you mentioned about the Magnum, you know, that again, a reaction perhaps to the Dirty Harrys that were going on
for sure,
you know, at the time, you know, for sure, you got to pump him up a little bit. And one of the things I've missed about him too was the essential Britishness of the series. Do you think that is a case? There's a loss of Sean Connery's were very English. Do you think it was a case of that? That there's a lack of, quote, Britishness into the – I don't mean that in a facetious way. I meant something that's unique about it.
Speaking for my country.
Yeah.
I think these all feel, like, British enough. I consider the Bond franchise to be – like at its core British, but it's also a very international franchise. Like it travels the world. It's traveled to almost every country at this point.
Except Canada.
he'll get here. We'll let him in.
I mean, I would think you lost that even before Roger Moore started. I think Diamonds Are Forever, which is one of the worst Bond movies, because it's terrible. It's a bad movie.
So much fun.
I think that one that really puts it out there as far as what kind of movie we're making at this point, where it feels much more embracing of how big of a phenomenon it's become. And not really regarding
my middle name is Klaus Hergesheimer. What do you mean?
Okay, well, let's get on to the villains, shall we? I had a segue, but then people kept on talking, so I can't use it.
Yeah. Well, I needed to insult Diamond Forever because I know you like it.
I had a lot of fun with it. I understand that it's not a good film, but I had a lot of fun watching it. It's the Moonraker rule. Yeah, Moonraker. We'll get there, but I enjoyed my experience of watching it. Anyway, so villains. We have a collection of entertaining and not entertaining villains in this franchise. Any that stand out for anybody? So the kind of selection that we have, we've got Francisco Scaramanga with Christopher Lee, which is a great name for a character played by Christopher Lee, and his henchman Nick Knack, Hervé Villechaize, who I initially thought his name was Nick Knack Tabasco, just because like, that's what he's called at the start, like, when Scaramanga calls out for Nick Knack Tabasco. That's a great surname, but it's not the case.
You didn't see the tray with the Tabasco on it?
I did afterwards. Like, when he yelled it, I thought he was calling for his full name.
That's just one of their jokes they have.
Yeah. Then you've got, in The Spy Who Loved Me, you've got Strongberg, played by Kurt Jurgens, and the aforementioned Jaws. There is another henchman in there as well whose name I didn't catch. It's like Chunder or something.
Yeah.
It didn't last long.
It doesn't matter. They have Jaws.
Yeah. In Moonraker, you've got Michael Lonsdale as Hugo Drax and The Return of Jaws. And there's another henchman in there as well, Chang. And in Fury Eyes Only, you have, I don't know, It doesn't really matter.
You have Glover. You have The Last Crusade.
Yeah. You have Julian Glover as Christatos, and initially you have potentially Topol as Columbo, but it turns out he's not a bad guy. He's a good guy.
And you have Blofeld. Or sorry, okay. Not. You have not Blofeld.
Yeah, you have Blofeld, and you have henchman is Eric Kriegler, this shirtless skier. And then there's the guy with the glasses who gets killed as well, Locke, I think his name was. So amongst those, any good, any bad, what do we like, what do we hate?
Before we talk all about how Scaramanga and Christopher Lee is the like one of the very few good elements of the Golden Gun and how Jaws is great.
Yeah.
I want to focus a little bit on Michael Lonsdale as Hugo Drax, because I think he's terrific.
Yes.
I really like his constant irritation that Bond won't die despite all the elaborate attempts he has to try to kill Bond, whether it's using the gravity thing in the training center or blowing him up death by snake or death by Jaws multiple times.
They lean into it because like you've constantly eluded all of my interesting ways to kill you.
Mm-hmm. Let me say, Michael Lonsdale has all of the best villain lines, and he has the black hole of charisma. I mean, he has none. He's got the best lines to say, and he says them in the most boring manner possible. There's rarely any delight or sarcasm. I know that the lines have edge. He doesn't have any edge when he's saying them, and I found him to be kind of a non-entity as a villain.
I disagree. I mean, as far as like a capable like person to fight Bond, sure. Like he's whatever. He's Michael Lonsdale. Like he's not an action guy. But like as far as his, I think the dry delivery and the sarcasm comes across great to me. As far as what he's putting out there, I think he gets the movie he's in. I think he realizes what he's required to do, which is just basically a step up from Kurt Jurgens in Spy Who Loved Me.
I think he's also not good.
Wait, yeah, I agree there, because that's despite how much I really like that movie, I don't think he's very effective. He literally sits at a table like the entire movie, like there's nothing for him to do, and he even has like webbed hands, and they don't give him anything to do. So it's like whatever. But, like Michael Lonsdale, just because Moonraker is basically a remake of Spy Who Loved Me, like they just did it again and slightly bigger. I think Michael Lonsdale is a standout for me. Like he tends to, when I think back on Bond villains. Like, if I think of it, like, all in pure stereotypes, Michael Lonsdale is one that comes up for me as far as guy that says, like, cutting lines to get back at Bond. Like, it's all there. It's all, like, if I think of bad movies now, I think of, like, Kenneth Branagh in Wild Wild West. He's, like, it seems like he's doing Michael Lonsdale, just, like, his ridiculous, like, sitting and trying to just trade barbs with Bond.
I love that comparison. I liked Lonsdale as Drax as well. I if we were going to rank the four main villains of these, he's number two for me. It's just below Scaramanga. I agree. He's not the most charismatic, but I don't think the character's supposed to be. He just feels like this kind of quiet guy who just wants to create this new civilization in space.
Create a new world in space.
Yeah. You know?
One of those things.
You know, it's normal.
The quiet megalomaniac.
Yeah. I didn't think that much about Stromberg. He's fine. And I was annoyed by the villains of Fury Eyes Only just because I didn't like the fact that, I didn't like there's a twist that you don't know who the villain is until like halfway through. I like these Bond films to be, like, Moonraker has the best kind of template for me in that Bond and the villain meet each other 14 minutes into the film, and they establish this is the good guy, this is the bad guy. They're going to try and kill each other for a bit and then go to space. Whereas Fury's only is a bit more twisty, a bit more turning. It's like, oh, it's this guy. Oh, no, actually, it's this guy. The guy who told you it was the other guy.
Four different people that you're dealing with. You got Gonzalez, you got Locke, you've got Eric Columbo. Krieger, you've got...
You kind of have Columbo, but he turns to be a good guy.
It's funny because I don't disagree, like, because I'm not a fan of Fury Eyes Only. This is my least favorite of this four set of films here, and I know a lot of people like this movie a lot, and part of it is because it goes against the grain of the template that's been laid out at this point. It's like, well, we went to space. What else can we do? Let's try to ground things down a little bit more. It's like, well, that makes sense, and I should like that, except
that'll be
I don't
me
like,
later.
I don't like how it's executed, I guess, like, because like you're saying, like, there's just things that... I'm basically just bored by it. Like, yeah. It doesn't really excite me. And I think and a lack of charismatic villains, Julian Glover being one who I think does this better in The Last Crusade, which also has a twist of him being a villain.
Any other film that he's in, I'd say he's
better. It does a better job of handling something like that, where this is just like, yeah, all right, we got some guys here, and one needs revenging.
Yeah, I was bored as well. I'm glad you agreed, Aaron. But yeah, I was thinking, like, yeah, they've been to space. What could they possibly do next? Nothing. Was like
they go rock climbing.
They go rock climbing. Wow.
They kill not Blofeld.
are we going to continue the villain discussion?
I think
we're going to talk about Christopher Lee. Let's circle back around to the start,
shall we?
Because I think that's what everybody's waiting for anyway.
Off you go then, Richard.
Well, Christopher Lee is great. I mean, he's good casting for the part. He looks fantastic in those white suits. He's got that great voice and presence. I wish he had a little bit more to do with the plots and the actions, but as a character in the background, he's really effective. And of course, the threat at the end, you know, they set that up with the funhouse thing at the beginning, and then we've got a replay of it at the end. And I think that both of those sections bookend the film really well and give him a chance to shine. It's the stuff in the middle that's maybe a little bit weaker, but that's okay. He's got, like I said, I think he's got the face and the personality to carry off the villain role. He's not really the mastermind of the whole plot. He kind of hijacks the plot that's going on. And that's an interesting little twist on it. He's the middle manager, so to speak, who takes over. He had the right location and he had the right opportunity as a plot. That's kind of an interesting twist on it. Idiosyncrasy of engaging in sexual activity only when he's about to kill somebody, that's icky, but it was also, you know, it was also an interesting character point.
As an actor, he's the only one having fun in this movie. Like, that's...
And probably, he does seem to be having fun, yeah.
And probably, like, Hervey Village has, because he's like, I'm in a movie. Yeah. I'm in a Bond movie. Great. Like,
I feel like Clifton James is having fun, but no one wants him there.
No one wants Clifton James anywhere.
Speaking of villains.
He's the most racist character in Bond films. Yeah. That's what he is.
Other than maybe some of the writers, I don't know. But yeah, Sheriff Pepper is terrible, isn't he? Why did they bring him back? Why? For what purpose?
Apparently he was popular.
I feel like it made sense to have him in Live and Let Die. We kind of talked about this on the last one of these shows where that film can be viewed through the lens of all of these African American characters are bad guys, and they had to put in a white guy who was like awful in different ways to kind of balance it out. And then just bring it back, kill him.
It's a weird, like, of all the characters you could, like, there's no Felix Leiter in any of these movies, but we need to have Sheriff J.W. Pepper back in this movie.
These four films, there's quite a lot of like running jokes between them all. There's the guy who looks at his bottle of drink.
Yeah, the double take guy.
Three of them. Isn't that the final three films he's in?
That's fun.
I don't mind. It's just I find it odd that I've just randomly got the four films where there's like.
Well, that's the thing. There's a lot. I think there's a lot of things that are characterized about these Roger Moore films that are like a 2 second gag, and it's like, does that really ruin your 2 hour movie experience? Versus like, yes, the entire character of Sheriff Pepper who is there for 20 minutes, is like, yes, that's a problem. But I'm not gonna like fault a movie I'm otherwise enjoying because like you see a shot of a pigeon, like that doesn't bother me. Like,
but it's such a terrible shot of a pigeon. It's not even the pigeon.
It's a gag.
It's not even that the pigeon does a double take. It's a poorly executed double take. It's a really terribly edited thing.
When Bond 25 comes out and it reuses the pigeon as a key villain that's behind all of Bond's...
If the pigeon is the architect of all of Bond's troubles...
Behind Bond all this time, you're going to come to me. You're going to be like, you were right. They needed to establish this.
If there's a moment where Daniel Craig's Bond has to line up a shot and shoot somebody and he misses because the pigeon shits in his eye, I will be fine with that.
I mean, that seems like all of Spectre to me on a thematic level, but okay.
So we like Scaramanga.
Can we bring back the three blind mice from Dr. No as well, too?
Yeah, fine. So what about the hench people? Obviously, we've got Jaws. Let's just step aside from Jaws for the moment, because, again, that's another kind of callback where he's in two of these films. Aside from Jaws, we've got Nick Knack.
Nick Knack bothers me.
Why does Nick Knack bother you?
It just feels like a weird accessory, more than like a like it's a dwarf manservant.
This is my Nick Knack.
What Scaramanga seems like such a unique figure, and he's like, and he has this guy like watching over things, and he messes with him. It's like, I'd love to, like, if there was a prequel exploring that relationship, I'd be interested just to know how this happened, where like Scaramanga's like, I have this fancy island with a fun house inside of it, and I have this little man who helps me obtain people to shoot in the face, but also teases me with ways that I could possibly lose and get shot in the face. It's such a weird little relationship he has. And then he tries to go after Bond in some reason. It's like, all right, okay. He blew up your island, I guess.
It kind of feels like, I haven't seen any of the films, but the Pink Panther, there's the manservant of the Pink Panther who's always attacking the Inspector Clouseau, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe that's just a weird 70s thing I don't get.
It kind of feels like that, where...
like, people had manservants back then.
Yeah. As you said, these don't feel British, honestly.
There's this idea of, let's have something novel. And, you know, the old definition of novelty used to be, you know, if a dog bites a man, that's not news. If the man turns around and bites the dog back, we can put that in the paper. Let's find something unusual and different. So they went two different directions in back-to-back films. Let's get a diminutive henchman, secondary character, you know, and then we'll go to a ginormous henchman, you know, with, you know, like you said, abnormal teeth. You know, and they did it back to back, trying to make the movies unique and interesting and different. And I liked both of those characters. I thought that they were perfectly fine. Nick Knack is, of course, partly comic in the way he is being portrayed in the films. And of course, the payoff at the end where he gets shoveled into a suitcase. I thought, you know, that's clearly one of those moments where there is a little bit of, I don't know, maybe harsh humor, but it worked. But in other situations, I mean, he's actually smacking Bond around. He's the one who conks him in the back of the head, and he's about to stab him in the face before he gets stopped.
Yeah, he does get the better of Bond, so
yeah,
he has that going for him.
Yeah. And so he's an interesting enough character. And of course, Jaws was interesting enough to bring back twice. Maybe double dipping was not necessary, but he was a good character.
I think double dipping is entirely necessary with Jaws. He's, you know, they've, as we talked about on the Spoiler Loving Show, they've reshot the ending because they wanted Jaws to survive because people loved him so much. So to bring him back, it makes no sense to bring him back until you get...
Well, he's a hitman.
Right. At the start, when you kind of got the cold open with like Bond on the plane, and then Jaws just appears and pushes him out of the plane, is Jaws part of that plan? Was he just there anyway? Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know exactly.
Clearly, I enjoy it as an explanation. I
saw it in the movie, so yes, that's the answer.
It makes more sense when Drax is... existing henchman when Chang is killed, and he just calls up the henchman hotline and says, I need a new guy to replace Chang. Could you get him? Oh, that'd be great.
Oh, he's available?
Of course, I just love that there's, like, Jaws has this reputation, despite the fact that he hasn't killed Bond. He didn't kill Bond, he failed. He still has a reputation for, like, being the best in the business. I love the world that sets up. The positive.
Are we talking about Jaws?
Yeah.
Is that podcast talking about Jaws?
Yeah.
Richard Kiel, especially in Spy Who Loved Me, there's a comedic value to him, but what I really like about Jaws is how threatening he is in that first movie. He is a horror villain in the first movie.
When he appears in the wardrobe, in the closet, on the train,
That's a jump
scare. When he's in Egypt stalking the scientist or whatever, like, it's sad and scary to watch because you have this menacing figure that's not going to be stopped going after this guy. Like, there's something there. There's less of that in Moonraker, but there is that scene where he's dressed in that big purple costume thing, and it's like, yes, there's comedic value to that, but it's also this unstoppable killing machine that's going to probably bite this person's head off unless he's stopped. Like, there's something there that I do think registers on top of being just this wacky figure in a James Bond movie.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that wackiness in Moonraker, which we will get into.
Well, let's get into it now. We're talking about Jaws. He's in two of these films, so we can talk about the wackiness. He gets a love interest. She's tiny. There's a lot of speculation. I think there's a Berenstain Bears kind of thing, where does she not have braces? She doesn't. But apparently a lot of people remember that she does have braces, and they watch this film and think, she doesn't have braces.
She doesn't.
Mm-hmm. I think she should have. That's the campaign.
They might as well have done that, you know. Yeah. They did every other cheap joke they could think of, so they should have added that in, too.
I like that they... It fits in with the tone of Moonraker that he gets a love interest and is toasting, here's to us, on the space pod shuttling through space that somehow manages to land fine. And they survive at the end.
We're talking a lot. I want, because Terry, you've certainly shown your kind of distaste for the tone of some of these films. Where are you at with these wacky side characters?
Well, Nick Knack, I thought, you know, he's it's an interesting sidelight that you bring that up, because you know you have the actor, you know, the 7 or 6 foot 10 Christopher Lee, and you have the little Hervé Villechaize, you know, which, you know, kind of a comedy thing. I think it lost, I think the comedy loses a bit. I think you also have to have in dark film, you also, if you can't be all dark totally. You have to have some comic elements of it. I think, again, with that and with Dolly, the girlfriend of Jaws, and the Jaws character in general and everything, I think they lost the edge in these films. I think sometimes the comedy overpowered it. Again, these are action films. You know, they're lighthearted films. I'm not a huge fan. I was not a huge fan of Jaws. I think Jaws is a pretty sad figure to be in it. You have this gorgeous actor, you know, Richard Kiel, who is obviously very similar to Lurch in the Addams Family.
Yeah.
He went on to play Lurch in the films.
Yeah. You know, these wonderful characters and everything. And I'm going, you know, how would you equate him to Oddjob? You know, people would say Oddjob was that kind of a character. But my goodness, you know, these people were put in for comic elements. And
Oddjob, there's an inherent comedy to him as well. I mean, he's a giant manservant that throws his hat at people.
Yeah, he decapitates a statue with a hat.
Yeah.
With a hat.
Well, a lot of those.
Yeah, there's a big difference between, you know, throwing a bowler and cutting off the head of a statue and flapping your arms like a duck as you're falling through the air.
That's the second film silly. For sure. I mean,
that's
but,
just silly.
But I do think the first film maintains that kind of menace in the same way that Oddjob is supposed to be. Obviously, there's tonal differences between Goldfinger and Spy Who Loved Me, but I still think that it holds on to, like, neither of them are Red Grant. Like, they're not. No. They're not trying to be this.
We can all agree with that.
This epitome of death.
And Richard, if you fall out of a plane without a parachute, you're not even going to try and fly. You're just going to give it a shot.
I'm going to point myself as sharp as I can so that when I hit the ground, I make sure that I don't remember any of it.
You just aim for the giant circus tent that's going to be behind you.
Yeah. I'm not aiming for the circus tent. I'm aiming for the concrete because I'm not going to survive. Nobody's going to survive.
Jaws, I think with some of the villains, just drifting back there for a second, and with the henchmen, with Kurt Juergens doing his bit, I think that was a budgetary thing. I think that was a production thing. Wasn't it originally supposed to be Blofeld? And there was some legal thing that couldn't do that, and so they had to make him something
most
else.
Most of these movies suffered from the whole split going on and the various lawsuits that
the
kept Spectre from being involved up until, you know, now.
So I think, you know, then they probably went, oh my goodness, you know, he can't do this what Blofeld did before. He can't wear the cool Nehru jackets and everything that they all wore. You know, so they have to figure out different things. I think you know, I'll go back to my original point. I think the comedy with a lot of these people and the funness and trying to make them lighthearted, I think overpowered the story, and they became caricatures.
Oh, Rebecca, what are your thoughts on these villains and these sidekicks?
I'm generally quite positive towards them. I feel like, especially with Nick Knack, at least he was given. I feel like he was given enough of a character to not, for it to not be him to be just a novelty, essentially, to the film. I feel like he was given a bit more of a character. Yeah, and even with Jaws in Moonraker, I feel like he, did he have one line? Did he have, like, I know he had
the
steel
teeth. In
Spider-Man,
but... he doesn't. In the Moonraker, he gets like a line at the end, like, "Here's to us."
It's just, yeah. It's
like, a little toast.
I did like them. I feel like they were given enough of a character, enough of motivations. I mean, Christ, even after, you know, Bond and Goodnight are away and is even still got his own motivations to go and try and kill Bond for whatever reason. That's a bit weird, but still, he still had some sort of his own agenda. So I quite liked him. Yeah, I'm generally favourable towards him. I feel like Dr. No had fake hands, didn't? I mean, that set the pace for the rest of the films. I feel like with these larger than life, you know, megalomaniac. My motivation is I just want to be rich. My motivation is I just want to be the most powerful person in the world, kind of thing. Obviously, there's a bit more to it than that, but generally, that kind of follow that line. So. You know, there's this, this pantomime aspect of these Bond films where they are a bit caricatures. But I quite like them. In fact, they get boring now that they've set that up. I feel like if they don't have that, like we said with For Your Eyes Only, me the villains were lackluster, the henchmen were lackluster. It was just a bit like you couldn't have. This guy's the villain, but we're going to turn around and have it as this guy the villain. If the villain was set up as someone like Scaramanga, because of course he's the villain. How could he not be the bad guy?
He has three nipples.
Exactly, he has three nipples. So,
Which apparently one in 18 people has, and I call bullshit on that statement.
I only know that Harry Styles has got one. I don't know about anyone else.
I take it all back. I'm sorry, Harry.
Yeah, so I quite like that they go with it. In fact, and I quite like the fact that Blofeld's not in any of these films. So I was getting really tired of, oh, it's Blofeld again. Oh, look at it, it's Blofeld again. Oh, look who it is, it's Blofeld. Like, I really liked when Goldfinger just went completely off and had someone new. So I do like the new villains in each film. That's something I really like.
Have you seen Spectre?
Yeah, but okay. I don't. You know, I know.
Just but, checking. That's good for playing disappointment. That's all.
Yeah, no, I can't really remember it. But no, like fair enough. Bring him back every now and again. I'm just saying. You know, it's Blofeld again. Better not him.
Jay, could you believe that Christoph Waltz was Blofeld?
Oh boy,
I didn't like it. I could have seen that coming.
We're going to have this discussion down the road.
Yeah,
folks.
That's in like 8 months' time.
Who could have saw that coming? He was Blofeld.
You know, we had lots of actors do Blofeld too, and everything. So wasn't there some sort of a thing when he loses his face and he gets regrafted or something like that?
Yeah, that's never say never again, isn't it?
I'm straying away here. Sorry,
that's fine. We've made it two topics into the conversation.
Yeah,
1 hour in. Okay, well, let's...
Blame me.
No, it's fine. It's if anyone's fault, it's mine. Everything.
Probably my fault.
We're here to talk about Bond. We're talking about Bond.
I'm willing to blame
we're having a good time.
You.
So let's move on to the women of the films, the Bond girls, as they're occasionally called, the Bond women, as I'm trying to change it to. So there's a few. Some of them are good. Some of them are Britt Eklund. So you've got in the Man.
There's a binary.
In The Man with the Golden Gun, you've got Britt Eklund as Mary Goodnight, Maud Adams as Andrea Anders, and there's a couple of others in all of these films. Spy Love Me, you've got Agent XXX, Barbara Bach, and Caroline Munro as Naomi. Moonraker, you've got Lois Childs as Dr. Holly Goodhead. Just for reference, the only one of these films that my wife sat through the entirety of was Moonraker, because I kind of made her. I just wanted to see her reaction to most of it. She abandoned The Man with the Golden Gun after 20 minutes, and the same with The Spy Loved Me, and didn't even join me for Your Eyes Only. So she was there for Lois Childs as Holly Goodhead. And then you've got, For Your Eyes Only, Caroline Bouquet as Melina Havelock, and Lynn Holly Johnson as BB, the ice skating 23-year-old who's like 16. I don't know. Which one do we hate the least? Other than Agent Triple X.
Well, I mean, yeah, Man of the Golden Gun is easily like the weakest in this scenario. I mean, yep. The Goodnight character is terrible. Like, there's nothing. It's terrible in terms of both how it's being performed and what their role is in the film, because it's just to be like just taken down a notch every single step. And she's supposed to be what, like an agent? And
it's not like she's just some rando off the street. Like, she's supposed to be working for the British Secret Service, and she's thick as fuck. She's so annoying.
And she's been posted in like Hong Kong for 2 years. That's like really terrible exposition explaining that. So she's like been working on this, and initially she's not terrible because she is, but redeems herself when she like scares off the people that Bond is supposed to be tailing, or he distracts him from doing that. But then when he says like, "Oh, they're in a green Rolls Royce," she knows where that's going. So she has this one good moment where, and then everything
when
else
she gets
is just
captured. Yeah, that was the best moment.
Everything else is terrible.
I mean, going from there, though, for better or worse, I think all of the other Bond women do have more agency in the preceding films. One's a spy for Russia. One is a scientist slash secret CIA agent that
slash astronaut.
Knows plenty of things about the whole space scenario. And the other one is out for revenge. She has her own plot totally. Right. Like her being with Bond is just more of like a, well, this is the end of the movie, so that's required. But besides that, it's just like, I want to get revenge on my family that you murdered, Julian Glover.
These are definitely some of the best Bond women that we've seen, 100%. Because after A Spy, You Love Me, I feel like that was just a breath of fresh air. After the atrocity that was Goodnight, and then you come to The Spy Who Loved Me, I was just like, oh, finally. Like, even though they play around with it a bit, I'm fine with that. I'm just happy she's here, to be honest with you. And I'm glad that it doesn't go down from there. We have Dr. Goodhead, okay, fine, the name's a bit weird, but it's not the worst. We just kind of do well from there, and it was just a breath of fresh air, really. I really enjoyed all of the Bond girls apart from Goodnight. I would have preferred her just not to be in the film.
Take
her out.
And the whole climax, she is just in like the skimpiest of bikinis and makes no efforts to not be.
Well, that's it. That's one of those things that is about that movie that is so dumb. She's the stupidest character in any Bond film, and she single-handedly wipes out the one guy who's running the whole factory or the whole secret lair there with his, you know, sketch pad. I mean, it's like, boom, she hits it, and it's done.
And then causes the island to blow up.
Yeah, yeah.
So, there you go. So.
It's the kind of thing where the rest, like, all the Scaramanga Bond stuff, and I guess Knick-Knack by default, like, that's good. But meanwhile, you have all these weird tropes. You have scary black man attacking innocent, like, Bond woman. Like, it's just, what's happening here? And then, inadvertently, the whole island blows up. It's just, this is good.
And doesn't he sleep with Andrea Anders while she's in the wardrobe? Yep. And then she's just totally fine with that.
He stuffs her in the wardrobe. She's in there for a couple of hours. And, Bond and Andrea.
I think
Andrea
he even goes out at one point and comes back.
Yep.
Yeah, he does his taxes, he reloads his bullets, like, he does a lot of stuff. Yeah,
pedicure,
he eats new milk.
Just the worst.
Yeah.
It's not a lot, like, it's sort of just drifting back to my point about the comedy overtaking the actual film. You know, like, all these goofy things are happening, yeah, but, hey, let's not lose track of a story. I think that was that's my take on the four films that we're talking about today. Sometimes they drifted away a little bit, got a little bit overpowered with some of the gags, some of the lines, and we forget this is a story about something, and I thought it lost.
I have a question for you, Terry, because I'm curious so I can get a frame of reference here, because I look at, once Goldfinger hits, that establishes like the template. Like sometimes there's variation on how they handle it, but it really establishes what Bond movies are going to be doing to satisfy audiences. Mm-hmm. And more or less, most of them do that for a good long time, and you get films that kind of go in and out. Some of them are more successful at that than others. Sometimes the story, yes, I mean, it's going to be rudimentary as far as Bond has to take this person on and he has to go through all these various struggles that are pretty familiar. What are your favorite Bond movies? I would assume it's probably From Russia with Love and some of the earlier ones.
Well, not in any particular order. From Russia with Love, definitely. Dr. No, because it was the beginning. Very tightly directed. You're going to think I'm odd, too, on this. I love Diamonds Are Forever, even though it was so frivolous. With all the, Plenty O'Toole and all this kind of stuff and Jill St. John and all of this is going on. Yeah, Sean looked a little aged in that. Somebody smells like a Tarte's handkerchief, and I think it's me, this kind of stuff. And I like Daniel Craig, if we're going to go all the way to it. Mm-hmm. I like all of this. Spectre had some interesting moments in it.
I agree.
I caught the, there's that section in, when he's going through the blown up building or something like that, and he has all the names written on the wall. And mm-hmm. I saw Emma Peel written on the wall, which I saw this in the theater, and I went, that's got Emma Peel on the wall. I'm going, why is that? Mm-hmm. Just sort of little things like this. I like a harder edge Bond.
Sure. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
That's going to dictate a lot of what a lot of people like about Bond. It's just what their flavor of Bond is.
Go ahead.
Just because it's a series and I just travel with what the wavelength it seems to be on. I can put myself ahead of whatever the story is being told just because there's other aspects of it that I'm interested in as far as whatever Roger Moore's doing or the locations they decide to visit or Ken Adams set design for given films. Like there's just a lot of that it does, like the ratio between how good the story is against what other else is going on. I don't worry about how much it overweighs the other, I guess.
I thought The Spy Who Loved Me, the film, mm-hmm. Was an interesting, an interesting look at things. I wish that if they did it by Ian Fleming's book, it probably wouldn't have survived when he actually writes the book, part of the book from the feminine point of view, and uses all, what is it, the three points of view or something. Mm-hmm. And
Bond doesn't even show up until the last quarter of the book.
Yeah. Or even, if we're drifting a little farther ahead with View to a Kill, when he's the assassin and you'd have sort of almost like a film noir, with mm-hmm. him sitting there watching, watching that. Would that have flown in the cinema? No. Would it?
No, no.
So, no, it wouldn't have worked. So, but that's a whole different discussion when you're talking about taking a title from a Fleming book and then rewriting an original story about it.
I think that speaks to a possible future because of where current society is and where they view Bond as far as what kind of things he's still exhibiting as a character. I won't be surprised if they do redo some of these Ian Fleming novels as a way to keep this franchise going, but also present it in a new light for a modern audience.
Absolutely. Have you read the wasn't not Forever and a Day, the second one previous to that came out with the new Bond book?
I have not.
No. We were talking about what hasn't he done. There's a whole section of it when he road races. He goes on the Grand Prix circuit, and he has to learn how to drive a Grand Prix car because he has to face a Russian spy.
We should have got a John Frankenheimer Bond film then. We missed out.
Yeah. That's going to kill.
That book's written in a retro style also. It's set in the 60s.
Yeah, that's the prequel to Casino Royale. And it was really cool. I thought, we're going to get a regular, we're going to get a Bond adventure and this kind of thing. And I thought, whoa, you got this guy is going on a circuit and everything. And the references to it and everything. It was, well, hey, I'm digressing, guys. We're talking
Jay, we're way off topic. What are we talking about? What's going on? Yeah. How are you doing?
I'm sorry. I forgot. We changed. We were talking about the women in the film.
Yes.
The Bond girls. Yeah. That's what we were talking about.
Oh, so we've already dismissed how terrible Goodnight is.
Yeah, I think we've done that.
And everybody agreed that Mary Goodnight is a terrible character, and everybody seemed to agree that Triple X of the four films is the best of the women characters.
Yep. Yeah.
And then the others are of differing qualities.
Yeah. I think for your eyes only, just it falls into the same problem the rest of the film has, where it's just like, well, it's there. Like, there's nothing excessively notable about. I mean, yeah, Jay mentioned that the BB doll character is also there, and it's like, all right.
Yeah.
We've also mentioned that Bond does reject her advances. I mean, that which noble for Bond.
This woman, less than half his age, there's one point where she's...
I don't know what the age of consent is in Greece, but it might probably have been one of those issues that he's thinking about.
But
finally, he's found the line.
She talks at one point to Chris Delsos, who's, Julian Glover, who's like her sponsor, and like she says, "I know what you want, but you're too old for me." Julian Glover, 9 years younger than Roger Moore. just had to point that out. So we talked about the women. Let's move on to... We've done villains. We kind of touched on some of the secondary characters. I'm not sure if there's any others that we want to pick out before we move off of the characters. We've mentioned J.W. Pepper. We're not going to mention him again. From any of the films, any kind of standout secondary characters for anyone?
What about M? Wasn't one of these pictures his last appearance?
Yes, Moonraker was definitely his last one. He passed away before For Your Eyes Only. That's why there's no M in For Your Eyes Only. They have the Minister of Defense or something instead.
The Minister of Defense and the Chief of Staff. That's the one character I want to talk about because I loathe that interpretation of the character. That guy is a terrible actor. He was directed to be snobbish and obnoxious. He is the most unctuous human being that exists in the Bond films, and I hate that moment. If you've read the books, Bill Tanner was a friend of Bond's. They were close.
Oh, shit, that was supposed to be Tanner. Together. I did not pick up on that being Tanner.
Yeah, and he's the Chief of Staff, and this guy is... he's the walking epitome of bureaucratic upper class snobbery, and I couldn't stand the way they portrayed that character in that movie. The Minister of Defense shows up in like three of these films, and he comes up pretty regularly, Freddie Gray, and he's fine. And it's interesting that the Admiral in The Spy Who Loved Me comes back as M later on in subsequent Bond films.
I didn't pick up on that either. Okay.
Robert Brown.
Aside from M, we've got Moneypenny's back for all of these. She doesn't have a lot to do in them, as ever, but she's, her presence is still nice.
Q, of course.
Yes, Q. Oh, I love Q. That doesn't do well. He's great. When he's got a random when he just appears in the monastery, not monastery, the confessional for some reason. That's where Bond is
revealed.
Well, it's because it was supposed to be M, but they couldn't do it. They involved him more.
Yes, that's why that makes sense.
Since you mentioned Q, are we going to talk about gadgets?
Yes, that was exactly where this was going to go. So let's do that now. So Q is obviously the head of the gadgets technical department. So there's a lot of gadgets to talk about in these films, and they're all great.
Even the third nipple?
Even the third nipple, because then you get the scene of Bond asking Q to make a third nipple. And Q's response of, really, 007, is just wonderful. Desmond Owen is a one of my favourite points of the earlier Bond films. So he's always a delight when he's... In The Spy Who Loved Me, when they're saying, how did they possibly, it's impossible to steal these plans. And he just pops up, actually, it's quite easy. he makes no friends. It's great. So amongst them, we've got like Scaramanga's gun. We've got the third nipple. We've got, I'm going to count the vehicles in these as well. So there's the...
Oh, we're counting the vehicles? Oh, the Lotus then. The Lotus is like
Lotus.
The
Lotus is awesome.
There's the DIY jet ski thing they have, the ski pole gun, the ticker tape watch, and all the other little random gadgets they have in the background of all of the Q scenes, the watch that shoots darts.
I like not only that that exists, but how much he uses it in the film. Like, it is quite useful.
It does everything.
It's a good gadget.
it takes out a whole simulator.
Yeah. It's still not clear how it is that he had it at the end, but that's okay.
He has it. You know, it's on his arm.
Yeah, in your space, in your spacesuit, you know, but that's okay. Yeah, that's it.
Don't leave. Bear in mind, they're in a space station with holes in the walls at that point, and they're still walking around fine. So no one has exploded.
Right.
It's funny that I can accept all of the gadgets in the Bond films, in these ones that we're discussing, you know, as being well thought out, and yeah, some of them a little bit silly, than I can more of the overpowered comedy aspects of it. You know, the gadgets added, you know, okay, let's figure out a different way to do things. And, yeah, they were fun. They were all well crafted.
My favorite gadget in the Bond films isn't one that Q came up with. It's the golden gun. That is just a terrific invention of how do we create a weapon that you can take almost anywhere. Nobody's going to suspect. It's going to be dangerous, and it looks so cool.
I hate it.
Oh,
I think it looks blocky and ugly and cumbersome. I don't like it at all.
Well, it's clearly not cumbersome.
It looks like it is. It's just really like, okay. I'm a designer. I design things. I'm a design engineer. So it just looks like it'd be really painful to hold and painful to use. There's these sharp corners everywhere. It just looks awkward. I know it's supposed to be.
It's not like those ergonomically designed guns that you're used to using.
Guns should be comfortable. You should be enjoying yourself when you shoot people.
He's an assassin. It's his job. It's his line of work. He gets his bullets made for him. He gets his gun. He takes pride in what he does. And he clearly has come up with a gun that is fit for purpose. So if anything, it's really thought about the design.
But it looks so bad.
This is
the weirdest hot take you've had in a while, Jake.
This would be the one item that I would spend a lot of money on to get a reproduction. You know, if it was one of those things that came up on eBay and they had a good one, I'd say, okay, I'm going to write a check. Damn.
It's got to be able to come apart, though, definitely.
Yes, it has to come apart. Yeah. You know, it can't just be a single piece.
So would you rather it function as a gun or it function as a pen, cigarette lighter, cigarette holder, and cufflink?
You can use it for all of those things.
All of those things, yes.
But realistically, if it works as a pen, it's not going to work as a gun barrel.
Are we talking realistically in the Bond films?
Yes, of course.
Just flipping through here, I actually found... you can buy the toy of the golden gun right
which
now.
Which really works as a gun and a cigarette lighter.
Yeah. Jingwan Golden Desert Eagle Toy Foam Dart Gun. It's made like a foam toy in the replica of Scaramanga's pistol. So.
All right, we're going to get a link on that in the show notes, right?
I'll try. The golden gun looks cool. It's a neat thing.
It just looks like a low-res gun. It looks like somebody drew something, scanned in, and they really scaled it down. It's just so blocky. I hate it. I hate it so much.
Yeah, and now he gets paid $1 million a bullet to use it. So, I mean, it worked out for him.
Yeah.
Oh.
Sounds like your job's a problem, Jay.
You have no idea how right you are.
Scaramanga's cigarette box bullet holder you can buy, too. So.
I just don't like it.
That's four. I'm not going to say the price. It's huge. But, it's anyway, off topic again. Sorry, I'm used to being a host.
Start a Patreon to get Richard that gun.
Yeah,
yeah. There you go. I'd love a working model too. You know, that comes complete with that specialized bullet that you can shoot. Although I don't think I could afford the gold version of it.
So whose name is on that bullet?
There's one now you can get. It's a 3D printed model of it. So
I could make that. I have one. Not gonna, because it looks terrible. Okay, so aside from the golden gun. And how wrong I am about everything. Any other standout gadgets?
The Lotus, as we mentioned.
Definitely the Lotus.
The Lotus car is fantastic. Yeah, it's such a fun Bond car. It's not even one that I think it's aesthetically pleasing necessarily. No. Like it's not an Aston Martin, but it's just this cool. It's so 70s.
Yes, thank you.
And the way, especially in because, I mean, it gets blown up in For Your Eyes Only, but the way it's used with Marvin Hamlisch's score in that movie racing around the tracks while a helicopter chases it, and it's shooting rockets, and it turns into a sub. Like, I just, that stuff's fun. That's all, that's a lot of fun to me. I'm sure it, you know, in the, in Terry's eyes, it's like, oh, this is too much comedy, but I'm sitting here thinking, this is silly. Like, I like this.
The disco submarine is so fun.
What about the boats? You know, they use a lot of boats in these too. Yeah. So,
that's true.
Oh, yeah, Road Racer is a big boat chase.
And an escape with a, what would you call that? A kite?
Hang glider.
Not a parasail. Yeah.
A hang glider.
Yeah, it's a hang glider.
Hang glider, that's it. That's the term I was looking for.
The late 70s, early 80s trend, hang gliding.
Yes. Well, they did all those kinds of things. Anything that was kind of trendy, let's stick it in the film. You got the water motorcycle. That was fresh on the thing. You know, when we talk back to Diamonds Are Forever, you got those three-wheeled vehicles in the desert at one point.
Yeah.
We had the hang gliding introduced in Live and Let Die also, but it comes back here for Moonraker, which is perfectly fine. But, yeah, the boats are pretty good. I mean, the boat in Moonraker, which is a problematic film, but the gadget is great. You know, it's got the torpedo that shoots out the back and the escape with the hang glider. I like that. As usual, it's, you know, I understand why Q is a little bit frustrated because they spent a lot of money getting these things together and Bond uses it for 10 minutes and then it's gone.
It chucks over a waterfall.
I mean, it's just proof of concept. Like, it makes it work.
Yeah,
he's still on the beta version of it.
There are also laser guns in Moonraker.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Which will melt your face.
Which will melt
but not
your
in space.
Face.
We don't get to see any of Drax's henchmen get face melted, which is unfortunate.
There is just this giant scene of lasers being shot back and forth, which is...
And it's great. You get a bunch of people getting shot with lasers in a movie.
Like, oh, it's fun. So bad. It's like a Roger Corman film.
It's not like a Roger Corman film. It's super exciting. Roger Corman film would look terrible. If you think that, if you think this looks bad, you have no idea what a Roger Corman version
I've
of
seen
Moonraker
Battle Beyond
like.
The Stars.
Yeah, so I have my own Battle Beyond the Stars. I know what that looks like.
I love the Lotus as well. Quite like the little X-ray cigarette case safecracker thing he's got in Moonraker. Just the little gadget comes out of nowhere. Just a little fun thing. I can't remember any from For Your Eyes Only. I watched it this morning. Were there any gadgets
so
in that?
It
took forever.
I don't remember any gadgets.
Other than
except, of course, the Lotus system. Explodes.
I mean,
parrot? Is that gadget? I don't know. Useful.
Lofeld has a remote he like controls the helicopter for a bit. You know, he's got that going for him. Because that was the idea, though. The idea was to make that movie grittier and less reliant on certain tropes. So,
it's like
I mean,
Batman Begins of Bond films. That's everyone's always said.
Isn't like the whole MacGuffin is what, like some kind of code machine or something too? Like some, that's
ATAC system.
Can operate the
can communicate with
weapon
submarines.
Systems. Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, that's a MacGuffin. Okay, well, let's move on to the songs, shall we? All of these films have songs. All the Bond films have opening songs. So we have The Man with the Golden Gun, sung by Lulu. The Spy Who Loved Me is sung by, I can't remember her name.
No, nobody
Carly
does it better.
Simon.
It sounds like
Carly Simon.
Carly Simon. Moonraker by Shirley Bassey, and For Your Eyes Only by, can't remember again.
Sheena Easton.
Thank you. I'm not good on 70s and 80s singers, I'm sorry.
Neither am I.
So, Rebecca, I know you have thoughts about Lulu singing in The Man with the Golden Girl.
Yeah, it's shit.
To elaborate?
Because it's so... because it's so screechy, anyway. It's just really like... I don't like Lulu anyway, so maybe that's just clouding my judgment. But yeah, it's definitely the worst. Spy Who Loved Me is the best.
She just makes you want to shout.
No, please. Yeah, I don't like it. I really just how sometimes you don't like songs. This foot was really screechy, and it was a bit too poppy and jazzy. That's why I like The Spy Who Loved Me more. I think that was the best one. I would say Moonraker's a bit forgettable.
Yep, I hated
that song. I was like, God, I really can't remember the song. And when it came on, and then about 2 minutes later, I was like, still can't remember the song. And yeah, 3 hours only is okay, I guess. It's definitely, it definitely felt like we were getting like into the 80s with that one for some reason. But yeah, so that's my general thoughts. Spike Love Me, great. Man with a Golden Gun, shit.
I mean, Nobody Does It Better is pretty indicative of what we're talking about right now. Nobody does it better than that theme song for this batch of films, let alone most of the Bond films in general. For Your Eyes Only, I think it's pretty good. Moonraker, I don't dislike, but it's less that I like the song and more that I'm just impressed that there's a song called Moonraker and yeah. Shirley Bassey is able to do something effectively with rhyming anything with Moonraker.
He
I mean, like, like next up is like Octopussy, where they don't even try. They're like, we're all time high. No, we're not doing this. And then now with the Golden Gun, lyrically it's terrible. Vocally it's terrible. I do like the beat of the song.
Oh yeah, there's a great melody and theme song.
But I think John Barry's score for that movie, I don't care for. Like, so it's a weird mix because I like the vibe. And it's coming right after Live and Let Die, which is also like, yeah, all right, this is great. Like, so it's like it's trying to follow that, but it does it terribly in almost every other aspect.
Yeah, I think this might be one of the weakest of the what we've done so far. This is the weakest set of title songs. The Spy Who Loved Me one is good. I know when we did that on the Zone podcast, I wasn't a big fan of that song. I couldn't remember it more than anything. Compared to these other three, it's a classic.
I think For Your Eyes Only and the Spy Who Loved Me song were both top 10 hits in the US. I don't know about the UK. They were big hits. The other two didn't go anywhere. And if you're talking about a set of four films and you were just measuring it on pop success, this is a pretty good collection. You're batting 500 here. When you say you thought it's kind of a weak selection, I think that's a little problematic.
I just give you my opinion.
Yeah. You're entitled to your opinion, no matter how wrong
it
is. I mean,
I have to live in a world. I have to live in a world where these two songs are pretty great, and the Sam Smith Spectre song won an Oscar. So I mean, this is what I'm dealing with here. So it's like,
I didn't say these were the worst. The Sam Smith Spectre song.
I have to put. Comparatively, it's like if that Spectre song is an Oscar winner and none of these songs won Oscars until Skyfall, it's like, okay, I need to adjust how much I praise some of these songs in comparison to what we actually have currently.
It feels like, from someone who doesn't know if the title came from a book or anything else, but Fiora's only really feels like the song came first and then they kind of just shoehorned the title in to the film. I don't know how it went, but that's kind of how it feels like, because they kind of just... For Your Eyes Only doesn't even make sense as a title for that film. Yeah. Or at least I feel like they could have come up with anything better.
It's a terrible title for a film. I hate it. It's the same with On Her Majesty's Secret Service. You could take that. You could take both these titles and use them to any of these films. I don't like it at all.
And I feel like the song is quite good. So it feels like, oh, we've got this great song. If you can work that into the film somehow, then that would be great. That's just how it kind of feels like to me.
Jay, I'm not going to...
It's the exact opposite. It actually is reverse engineered. You start with the title and then they create a song around that.
No, I know. I'm just saying that's how it feels.
Yeah. Okay.
Jay, I'm not going to deny that the titles for some of these are not great because they're very generic, but I just question, how many action movies do you love that have titles that just mean nothing? Like, how many 90s action movies do you praise over and over again, despite it being, like, whatever?
Well, but I feel like...
Like, who cares about Rush Hour? Who's like, man...
Okay, I've never praised Rush Hour. I've never praised Rush Hour. I don't like Rush Hour.
But you know what I'm saying?
The 90s action films that I like, the type, I can't say all of them, because there's probably some I can't think of right now, which are exactly what you're describing. But things like The Core, that title is about what that film is about. Like,
I mean, no one's going to disrespect The Core unless you're mad.
Deep Blue Sea, it's about the ocean.
They're Twister in the deep blue. It's a movie about sharks.
But it's about what the sharks want.
They want the deep blue sea?
That's a quote from the film.
That's their Hugo Drax goal?
That is a quote from the film. It's what does a giant mega shark want? It wants the deep blue sea.
Have been Smart Sharks.
In my eyes, every movie should be called Untitled Director's Name Film. When Bridge of Spies is coming out, which wrongly lost the Steven Spielberg poll that you're doing already to fucking The Lost World.
The Lost World's getting kicked out by E.T. today. Don't worry about it.
Good. Yes, thank you. But like when that movie was called Untitled Steven Spielberg Cold War Movie, that's what I wanted it to be called. That was my favorite title for a long time.
There would be no way to distinguish the three Lewis Gilbert films in the Bond franchise because they're all the same. Okay. Let's move on from the songs.
Spy actually did love him. That's a distinct title.
Okay, yes, but the same thing in all of them. If you say that the type of The Spy Who Loved Me is from the perspective of half of the female characters of the franchise, then it could apply
they're
to any
all spies.
Anyway, no, but the Bond is a spy. So if you say it's the woman,
Agent Triple X is also a spy.
I get what you're saying.
The double meaning.
Fine. Let's move on.
I'm sorry that, but yes, you're right. Moonraker is a perfect title because there's Moonraker shuttles. You're right. Correct. Never mind. Okay.
They go to space. The man with the golden gun. Title. He's a man, right? And he's got a gun that's golden. Okay.
Jay Cluett, Moonraker, perfect title. Moving on.
Better title than Fiora's on it. So we talked about the songs. What about the score? This isn't a topic that I like to talk about, but other people do. So any notes? I'm going to give you an opportunity too. I'm going to sit back and say nothing. Anyone say anything about the score of these films?
John Barry is a great composer. He does a terrible job with The Man with the Golden Gun.
He's responsible for that. The worst moment in that movie that ruins the best stunt that they did in the movie, because John Barry is the one who put in that penny whistle.
Yeah, when the car does the loop-de-loop, corkscrew turn, which is a brilliant stunt. I mean, nothing should...
The stunt is fantastic. and it's all undermined by the score.
Oh, and the passenger.
Yeah, that part, that's true. Yeah. Says the man who's going to sit back and let us talk.
That stunt is...
Hey, you're going to bring up a scene with J.W. Pepper, and I'm going to pipe up.
Okay.
That stunt is still fantastic, though. That was the first computer-designed stunt for a movie, because they had to, like, really make sure they had all the logistics down for making that turn make sense. And it's like, it is a fantastic piece of filmmaking. It's just, yes, it has a slide whistle attached to it, and it's like, okay.
And the Bill Conti disco stuff is not very good at all. I didn't care for that. The first half of the music in For Your Eyes Only worked pretty well, and then they get to the ski sequence, and it's like, oh, it goes off the rails there. It just does not function at all. It sounds awful.
I don't tend to know what the consensus is on Marvin Hamlisch's work, but I really like the kind of his disco take on Bond for, 77?
77,
like It works for me, like in just the context of the film. Like I'm like in the whole, even like the opening ski section, which has a lot of danger and threats as far as Bond facing off skis and jumping off a cliff and all that. Yet I still like the kind of bounciness that's going on with it. Like it works for me.
All right. And since we're talking about music, the musical bits of Moonraker that are stolen from other movies for the purpose of a joke are some of the most annoying. I mean, I laughed. But I don't want to be laughing at the film. I want to be laughing with the film. And the Close Encounters, the Magnificent Seven. Oh, you know, there was a Lawrence of Arabia slight suggestion in The Spy Who Loved Me.
Spy Who Loved Me, yeah.
You know, but they didn't overdo it, and they overdid it in, like everything in Moonraker, they overdid everything. They said, let's just.
I can't say I feel the same. I've never felt affected by the different things they do in Moonraker from a score standpoint. I like the general theme of it that goes with the forgettable song that we have when they go to new places or what have you. But that's me. I'm so keen on Moonraker as far as what it's doing for just being as excessive as it is. I think there's other things that get thrown over the top, but we'll talk about that, I guess, when we get to the story or whatever.
Terry, are you going to say something?
Yeah, no, I'm just agreeing actually with what's been said. The score is like, again, if we're going to make these pictures quirky, let's do something quirky. And they did them quirky. So, you know, with the exception of the theme songs, what do you people think of the title sequences? of them. You know,
with the Maurice Binder.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the Spy Who Loved Me kind of set this silhouette. Well, they did it earlier, but you know, that kind of set the standard. You know, we're going to have gymnastics on a gun with naked women and Russian hats. Okay. Mm-hmm. That worked okay. And then they kind of repeat it again in a couple of places. And, you know, I'm not sure that it works quite as well. The For Your Eyes Only is the oddest one with the, because that's the only one that we ever get the singer of the song appearing on screen.
Exactly. Yeah. The part of the music video. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably a marketing thing that they did in the early 80s saying, well, we've got this coming. Let's take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. Agree. Totally. Well, it's part of marketing. That's another aspect of these pictures. You know, when they discover how wonderful you can market things. So you use cars and boats and music and booze and everything else.
What soda bottle are you supposed to drink after you watch Moonraker, Aaron? Come on. You know.
British Airways.
Oh, you're supposed to take British Airways and order yourself a 7-Up.
Yeah. I did like that they, instead of having product placement, they just put billboards everywhere. That was fun.
Supposed to stand under the mistletoe, aren't you?
I mean, because these are they're event movies. Sorry. I mean, that's the whole aspect of it. Yeah. It's like when you're, you know, there's no Disney popping out, you know, a new film every 2 months like there are now. It's like, okay, it's a new Bond movie in the same way they're like the 90s, the Batman movies were like the biggest movies coming out at that time. Like Bond was an event. Like, it was a thing. Yeah. Everyone that wanted to be involved tried to get involved from all angles.
We'll do a Batman franchise look back at some point. I'm sure. Okay, we've got two topics left, which are the set pieces and the plots. I can kind of merge those two together because the set pieces follow the plots. So let's just go through film by film with the man with the golden gun. Bond receives a bullet with his name on it. And so the film is kind of about his reputation. Like, he's got this reputation for being the greatest secret agent, which even, like, he's known as the greatest secret agent, which means he can't be the greatest secret agent, because everyone knows who he is. Anyway. So I liked it being, like, a kind of a more personal story for him. Like, it's about him as a person, and what his reputation has, like, leads to, that Scaramanga wants to have this perfect murder of this perfect assailant, and that can only be Bond.
Everything you're saying sounds great in concept. Yeah. I don't see any of that in the movie.
I remember The Man with the Golden Gun. I'm not good at remembering the Bond films all merged together, but I remembered the plot of The Man with the Golden Gun. I remembered a lot of it. I didn't remember it being bad, but it was. And Scaramanga's great, and he is. That bit was correct. So everything else around him just wasn't. And I really. I meant to say about this when we're on the villains, but I didn't like the climax of The Man with the Golden Gun. It kind of built up to very little. Like, Scaramanga died very easily.
He has a funhouse.
I mean, yeah. But they don't use the funhouse enough.
Well, he's got to die in a gun duel. So, I mean, this is not... That's his whole character, is basically he's an assassin with the gun. You know, the idea of dropping him off of a cliff or shoving him into the trash compactor or having him cut in half with a propeller, that's not going to work. I think you have to have the showdown with the gun. I think that makes perfect sense.
I just found it anticlimactic. I don't know. What you're saying makes sense, and that it makes sense for the story. It was just, as an end to a film, it was kind of dull.
Location-wise, it's fine. I mean, yeah, it goes to what, Vietnam and Thailand? Thailand? That's where the island. Yeah. That's where the island is, right?
Yeah. Rebecca, where is it again?
Thailand. It's okay. In Phang Nga Bay, just off the coast of Phuket, if you want to know. I don't think he goes to Vietnam in that one.
He goes to Beirut.
There we go.
Yeah. With the belly dancer where he swallows her navel piercing. Which is weird.
Like, she loses her charm.
It just fell out, not from where I'm standing. But that just came out in his mouth.
Does anyone else in that fight sequence see that, like, you can see, like, the whole camera crew in the mirror at one point when he's fighting people?
I wasn't watching out for it.
Then that fight when like he's with the dancer and then like the other people come in and he starts fighting. There's a point where like he hits the mirror and it like reflects the entire camera crew in the mirror.
I'm sure it happened. Yeah, I'm watching these on standard def DVD. So I still haven't seen the bit in the Spoiler of Me where it's not Roger Moore. It's a painting of Roger Moore. So I just know that's in there somewhere. So yeah, it action sequences in Man of the Golden Gun. You've got the kind of the martial arts fights in the kind of the training house, which is good.
The boat chase,
which we talked about, and the car chase with the flip and the slide whistle. Good, bad, love, hate, anything. Move on to the next one.
We talked about the slide whistle, but yeah, the car chase is like there is fun to be had with the again conceptually and just visually seeing it. It's like yeah, they did do that corkscrew, which is not an easy thing to pull off.
The car chase is pretty good, I think. You know, they've got the car going up on the median and passing on the left or the right, depending upon which way the traffic is going. I thought it worked pretty well through traffic. The boat chase, you know, they have this sequence that they sort of repeat in a later film, in Moonraker, where one boat bisects another and, you know, drops it into two halves, and I liked that the first time I saw it. Second time I saw it, it was done for a joke, and it was okay, but you know, I think they went to the well once too often on that. But I like the boat chase in the Man with Golden Gun.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Do you think Roger's physicality as an actor stood up in all these pictures? You know, I think we touched a little bit before about it was like beating up an old man type thing. Do you think it helped him? Do you think it hindered him?
I thought they played it pretty well with the Man with the Golden Gun when he's got that confrontation. He wins the first fight by basically just kicking the guy while they're bowing. And then, you know, when they get into the big confrontation, he gets pushed in the background by the two teenage girls.
He gets the last punch in. Yeah, he gets to finish it, but he doesn't do anything else.
Well, he's James Bond. Like that's what the producers were going to have him do. He's Bond. He's supposed to be that kind of person. Like, but yeah, we did speak on this earlier. It's just I think for what they give him to put, what they put up against him from a fight standpoint, I think matches who Roger Moore is in these films. Later on, okay, but these films, it never doesn't make sense to me.
It was kind of like with the two women, with the Bambi and Thumper, you know. And, that was vicious, but, so we'll try this with Roger and see how that works and everything. Nothing wrong with that.
Okay. So if we move on to The Spy Who Loved Me.
Well, obviously the ski jump at the beginning is the thing that is most spectacular about the film. It's the thing that most people remember, you know, and the guy really does it and it looks great on screen, and when the Union Jack comes out of the backpack and it's a parachute, everybody laughed and applauded and was thrilled.
I mean, laughed? That is a moment of national pride.
Canadian pride.
Well, maybe they weren't laughing in Great Britain, but in the United States...
You stand
States,
up and salute when
we all laughed, you know, it was all great. You know, we enjoyed it. It was like, oh, this is perfect.
Oh, I just realized that when we talked about supporting characters and villains, we forgot one right at the end of For Your Eyes Only. Speaking of Britishness, which when...
Oh my god! I think I've blocked that out. That was horrendous.
When Margaret Thatcher shows up. Okay.
If you're talking about... I mean, you're going to talk about the plot for Spy Who Loved Me. We've gone over this in that Movie of the Month episode, but I know we've talked a lot about story being outweighed by things. I think Spy Who Loved Me, I recognize the flaws in some of these other Roger Moore Bond films. I do think the story holds a lot of water here. I think it is very direct in what it's trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
There was no pun intended. I do think it's direct in what it's trying to accomplish. It has a take as far as its concept for this one with having a Russian spy and James Bond colliding in this thing and having to work together, what have you. But I do think it basically rides the template very well. Like, it's a very good example of what a typical Bond movie could be, just put above and beyond because of, I think, how it involves the various tropes that we see. I think it does a great job of it, and I think Ken Adams' production design is spectacular here, along with this and like You Only Live Twice might be like his finest hours.
Yeah, I think it's a good example of like the analogy you could make is it's the best model year of a car model that everybody admires, and this is the year that it was at its apex. And I think that that's The Spy Who Loved Me. You know, it's got all of the visual elements to it, enough story that holds it together, enough characters that make it work, and it flows very effectively. And Roger Moore is, you know, probably at his best in this particular film as a character. I don't know as an actor, but as a character, I think.
And plot wise, you've got the extra layer of Agent Triple X's like wanting to kill Bond at the end because right. he's the one who killed her partner. That's just another kind of fun layer to have in it.
I'd add, like, I think we've talked about kind of the edge that Connery has and Craig has versus Roger Moore. I'm not going to say he's down and gritty in this one, but he does, like, he gets his bits in. Like, he fights that one guy in the roof, he grabs his tie, he gets the information he wants, and just knocks the tie out of his hand. And like,
giant tie!
There's stuff like that that I do think is it exemplifies what Bond is supposed to be. The opening ski chase is why Triple X is so angry at him to begin with. He kills people that are, you know, skiing trying to kill him. I mean,
he kills people trying to kill him.
He's being the secret agent that he's supposed to be. He is pursuing the leads that he's trying to go on to find what's going on here. He gets rid of Jaws in a way that's it's comically ironic and it fits for like the persona he's established.
Yeah, that
kills. He gets rid of Jaws. You know, kill Jaws.
He dispatches.
Jaws bites a shark and gets away. Obviously, that's how things happen.
Okay, let's move on to Moonraker.
Deep Blue Sea.
Plot-wise, Moonraker is just nonsense. With the guy setting up a new colony in space with his kind of Noah's Ark of people. He's got this virus which only kills humans and no animals or plant life, which... No.
But Thanos did it.
Okay, Thanos is magic.
What does it matter?
Biology magic, botany magic.
Yeah, I mean, this one went through rigorous tests in a laboratory, so I don't know what the difference is.
I really liked the scene in the laboratory, actually, when Bond goes in there and he kind of accidentally... Well, he is looking at the really fragile-looking hexagonal glass canisters, which would like break when you just pick them up, I think. Too many corners.
Tell me something as you're describing this, because okay, the goal of him is ludicrous because yes, he wants just like The Spy Who Loved Me, he wants to make a colony under the sea. That's nonsense. I mean, but what about the plot of Moonraker is ridiculous?
The space bit, I think.
The last 20 minutes of a 2-hour movie where it's just a big action sequence. I mean, there's big action sequences at the end of all of these movies.
True, but this one's in space, so it's silly.
Well, it's.
How would it make coherent sense for the story?
It does. That's true.
It applies to what the movie's been told. Like, because here's what I have to say. Because I think Moonraker's underrated. I think it's doing what you expect a Bond film to do. And at that point in '79, after Star Wars, obviously, but also after, you know, 10 other Bond movies that have all gone bigger and bigger, this is naturally where you've led up to. Like that's where it's supposed to be. Even then, the path to getting there is still just a regular Bond movie. It's even pretty dark. You have a woman getting beaten or eaten by dogs at one point.
Oh, hell yeah.
It does a lot of things that are pretty edgy for a Bond movie leading up to them going to space, which is not like it came out of nowhere. It's not like it's like, I guess we're doing this now. It's like, no, the whole movie's about them hijacking space shuttles. Like,
Aaron, I'm on board. Of the four films talking about today, this is my favorite.
I'm speaking more to a wider audience because when I see lists of like worst Bond movies and Moonraker's at the top, it's like, what movie did you watch? Like that defies the logic of like I know what a bad Bond movie looks like, and the Moonraker is like it's a pretty standard Bond movie.
A bad Bond movie is the one after Moonraker.
Yes,
boring one.
Yeah,
the three after Moonraker.
I haven't got there yet. I can't remember. I remember View to a Kill. I have no idea what Octopus is about in the slightest. It's
no one does. And I watched it 2 days ago.
We'll find out in 3 months' time. But you mentioned the scene with the woman being chased by the dogs. Like, mm-hmm, that is not a Bond movie scene. That is like a horror scene. You could lift that up. That's a really, I didn't know what I was watching.
It's again why Michael Lonsdale, I think, is a solid Bond villain. He's pretty threatening. I mean, he doesn't get results with Bond, but he gets results elsewhere.
It's the dogs in that scene. But, yeah. So other action sequences we have in Moonraker, we have the boat chase that's already mentioned, which turns into a hovercraft.
The opening is great. I mean, yes, it's silly that Jaws is in the air at one point, but they are skydiving. Like, it is a cool action sequence.
No, the opening is one of the best things about Moonraker. Mm-hmm. That, you know, what it's got to do with any of the rest of the movie is not clear at all. But trying to figure out how you get out of a situation when you've been thrown out of a plane without a parachute, that's...
You try and fly.
That was a good stunt. It looked good. They made it work. They got some good drama out of it until the very end of that stunt, when we get the circus.
I mean, most of the openings, a lot of them don't apply to the rest of the movie. It's the cold open. Like, that's the point of it. Like, it's kind of there.
Yeah.
I mean, the next one you get non-Blofeld for basically no reason. Like, it's right. Like, all right,
out of spite, I think, more than anything.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, exactly.
Of course, we've already mentioned the climax of Moonraker is just space laser battle party, which if you want nonsense in it, then that's nonsense. But it's 1979, version of laser guns in space. So
it's still a big budget action scene. Like, it looks like a big budget action scene. There's a lot worse looking worse versions of that movie that exist.
But looking at it with 40 years of perspective, it's not great, but it's fun. I'm not trying to insult it at all. I get it.
Immensely. I mean, I sit around. I was watching Son of Kong last week. I don't really mind how old something is. Like, it's just like, I get it. That's what's going to look like at that time. Take one giant step for mankind.
And speaking of puns, however much you may not enjoy Moonraker, you have to enjoy, I think he's attempting re-entry.
Oh my gosh.
Just. Rebecca, your thoughts?
I don't know. Yeah, but I don't know if it's as bad as.
Moneypenny.
Well, it's not as bad as Moneypenny with 007. It's on a mission, sir, in Austria. Well, tell him to pull out immediately, and then it cuts to him on
He's
that.
On his last leg.
Oh, God. But this is the kind of thing where, do people think that Bond from this point, they've obviously, like. Well, this is just my thought. They've become known for certain things. Obviously, you've got the books as well, so they're already known for whatever's in the books. Are they kind of self-parodying themselves in the 70s? Like, they're upping everything that they're known for?
At this point, Roger Moore had played James Bond in Cannonball Run. So, yes, he has to know that he's a punchline at some point. Because he's a joke in Cannonball Run. Is Roger Moore is playing a guy who looks like Roger Moore and thinks he's James Bond. Basically,
I mean, the movies are all heightened to begin with. And yes, there's a knowing. I mean, that's Roger Moore's take on Bond. I mean, Jay, you mentioned this yourself. Like, he's the world's most well-known secret agent, so he's not really a secret. That's Roger Moore's actual take. Is like, well, if I'm a guy that every bartender knows what drink I have. That's how I'm going to play this. Like, there's no reason to playing it secretive. Like, it's like my stealthiness is not really the key accessory to my success in the business here.
Yeah, I guess I just wondered whether people thought that was just, that's just what he's like, or if they were actually, like, being a bit more, I don't know, self-aware, which I guess it's pretty obvious that they are. But they're just going along with it, aren't they?
I'm not arguing that it's like a perfect model every single time.
Oh, no.
At the same time, it works for me. It works for many of these films, not all of them.
I've got to correct myself before I get a deluge of complaints. Cannonball Run came up between Moonraker and For Your Eyes Only. Okay, I was one film. Just had to get that in. Either way, he was filming it at the time, probably. So moving on to For Your Eyes Only, I can't even begin to get into the plot here because it's so convoluted. I think of a boat draws in its a mine. I'm not sure if this is intentional or not, and it blows up the boat. The boat has this communication device on it, which goes to the bottom of the sea. People want it. there's the parents of Melina Havelock are marine archaeologists who are trying to find it, so they are killed so that she can go and find it, or to prevent other people from finding it. I'm not even sure. If anybody would like to explain it to me, please do.
I don't care enough.
Yeah.
there's some highlights here. I think the rock climbing stunt is very effective.
Rock climbing's good. It's a lot of tension there where he's got the I can't remember the name of them, but the hooks in the wall that the other guy is knocking out. The guy who's knocking him out is not tied on to anything. He is just holding a rope. That guy has brass balls. That he is just dangling over this very fatal cliff edge, just holding on to something, kicking a rock. I would have tied myself on. I don't know. But I think that's the only scene I can remember is the rock climbing from this film that I watched 7 hours ago.
I mean, this is the third time Bond skis in Roger Moore's entry in this series.
There's a good skiing sequence. There's a chase that exists in the toboggan run. I don't think that they've earned themselves any credit with the hockey fight. That doesn't really add anything to the movie.
With the goal score going up.
All right. But to me, this is, and I know that you guys sound like you're pretty down on this film. This one, to me, is one of the, well, it would be in the top half of the four films that we are talking about today, not in the bottom half. It's a straightforward spy story. You know, there is intrigue. You have two or three competing elements, trying to figure out who's on which side, what it is that they're trying to pursue, what their interests are. That's part of the plot. It's not a straightforward action film. It involves a lot more intrigue. I do agree that the characters lack much color, but that's, you know, not the fault of the plot. That's the fault of the characterization there. The plot itself is, I think, pretty standard spy stuff. And I like the fact that it is grounded more in reality. I like you said earlier, Aaron, you know, we've been to space. We've blown up a space station. We've had a massive battle between astronauts from the Earth and these other astronauts. Where are we going to go next? We got to go small. We got to bring it back to Earth. We got to give it some gravity here, and that's what this film tries to do. I think there are a couple of good sequences in it that we've talked about. I like the whole thing where they, unnecessarily try to kill Bond and Melina by dragging them across the coral reef and have the sharks come after them. That's right out of one of the novels, you know, so it got transplanted from one of the novels into the story, and I like it. I like the fact that it's there. Like you said, the characters, I think, are a little bit, I like the Topol character. I think he enters the story a little bit late in the process and doesn't have enough of the, you know, enough impact in the second half of the film, but I like the character and I like the idea that he's originally portrayed as being the villain, and then it turns out that he is, you know, not. It's the other guy that is trying to, you know, pawn it off on him. I like that bit in the
all his singing and dancing's a little much, but yeah, he works.
Yeah,
I like the little scuffle that you get between Topol and Julian Glover as well. It's nice, just these two kind of the older supporting characters. Just having a little fight. That's nice.
Richard, I so want to like this movie more. Like I said, when I rewatched all the Roger Moore Bond films to prep for this, just because I wanted to watch Live and Let Die again also, and just see if there's anything redeeming about Octopussy and V to a Kill, which, you know. But I sat down for this one thinking, okay, maybe this time I'm going to like it a lot more. Because like in concept, like we've mentioned, like it's trying to do something different. It's going a new way after going big with Moonraker. So it's like, this makes sense. Let's do this. But every time I watch it, I just can't get into it as much as I want to. I try it. It just doesn't do much for me.
Well, it's definitely not as fun as some of the previous movies. Cause it lacks, you know, there are a couple of humorous bits in it, which by the way, I think I kind of resent since they're going more grounded. The two things at the beginning and at the end of the film, I think irritate me, and they kind of undermine what they were trying to accomplish with the film. The whole thing with Blofeld, that's overdone. And then when he starts saying, "We'll make a deal. I'll give you a delicatessen in steel." You are kidding me. That's ridiculous. And then Margaret Thatcher shows up at the end, and I'm going, "No, that's a funny bit. It's, you know, topical and relevant to the time, but it's an example of what the kind of things that they were doing in the previous films that I thought they were trying to get away from, that they just fell back into that pile of bad jokes." But I understand. The tone is so different from the other films that I could understand why somebody doesn't enjoy it as much. And you're not the only person or the only people that I've heard say that this is boring. I think that the reason that it seems boring is because the characters are colorless, you know, the villains especially, not because the story is bad.
I just feel like it steals a lot of the story from the films in this section that we're talking about. Like, I'm sick of the films opening on like a submarine or a plane and they get stolen and like they have to figure that out and like the Russians are involved, and it felt like a tired version of stories that had previously come past. That's just how I felt. Maybe just watching them back to back and I'm like, oh, there's another submarine again, and oh yeah, okay, yet stolen, okay. I just thought it was the same. That's rehashed the same kind of story. That's just how it felt to me.
I agree to that too. I think a lot of these situations became plug and play for the screenwriters. You know, you had, obviously you had the excess of Moonraker, the silliness of Moonraker, and then you try to ground it back and everything, and you don't totally achieve what you want to achieve. But we'll take some sequences out of all these various films and we'll plug them into a screenplay and we'll see how it works. Well, there's your result.
Well, we got the mini subs in both Spy Who Loved Me and For Your Eyes Only. You've got underwater sequences, so I can see why it feels a little bit repetitive in that situation. But the plots are completely different. The plot of Moonraker and The Spy Who Loved Me is basically the same.
For Your Eyes Only is just cribbing a lot from Live and Let Die and Majesty's Secret Service and Goldfinger.
Okay,
but I think
it has the not Blofeld opening sequence, which is, I mean, silly as it kind of is, it does have a big helicopter chase, which is pretty cool.
A big remote control helicopter, yeah, with Bond on the outside of it.
It's got to fly through stuff. You know, it's always fun.
Yeah. Okay. We've been going for about 2 hours now, so I think we can do our final thoughts and scores out of 5. We're going to go through all of the films one by one, person by person, so this will take another 45 minutes or so. this is well planned. So, Richard, we'll start with you. Final thoughts and a score out of 5 for The Man with the Golden Gun.
The Man with the Golden Gun is a little bit embarrassing, but you know what? It gets better every time I watch it, and I enjoy it more every time I watch it. And it's got the best villain in the 4 that we looked at, so I'm going to give it 3.5 lambs.
Okay. Aaron?
It's a 3. I mean, I like Christopher Lee enough in it, and there's enough, like, despite some of the major flaws that I really think it has, it does have a lot of, it has a lot of stuff that's watchable. Like, it's not it moves along pretty quickly. It's not a boring film to watch, so it has some of the stunt stuff that works and what have you. So, yeah, I'm at a 3, Williams, for that one.
Okay. Rebecca?
I'm very much the same, a 3. It had some redeeming qualities, like the villain and the settings and some of the storyline. It had some terrible qualities, like the Bond girl and some of the sequences and plot. Oh, a bit boring. So, yeah, 3.
Okay. And Terry?
I'm going to give it a 3, just because it stands on Christopher Lee's Lee's presence. I love the location photography. I think it may have been a dress rehearsal for Fantasy Island for Hervé Vichelès. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I messed his name up and everything. But standing on Christopher Lee, acting on Roger Moore, yeah, I'll give it a 3.
Okay, I'm going to give it a 2.5. Most of that is for Christopher Lee and the setting, I think. Basically. So, Spy Who Loved Me? Aaron, we know you're a fan. What are your final thoughts on the score?
I mean, that's a 5 out of 5. I mean, that's one of my favorite movies. I mean, it does everything that I want in like a general Bond movie. It satisfies with. I mean, so it's yeah. I don't have much more to say about that. I've talked about it plenty.
Okay, Rebecca.
It's a 4 for me. I didn't really talk about this, but I didn't really like the ending. But I don't, to be honest, I'm not a massive fan of huge long action sequences. I started playing solitaire in the middle of that, and then I looked up and I was like, oh, they're still going. Okay. So that's I was never really going to be a fan of that. So, but the rest of it, loved it. Was completely hooked for the rest of it. So 4 out of 5.
Okay, Terry.
2.5 on this one. Reason being, silly special effect of that hideaway, you know, a little bit of a model. Yeah, we can see that. I know it's a technical point, you know, the CGI and everything wasn't what it was then. I was getting a little tired of everything has to be Soviets and Russians and everything in this one, but, yeah, I'm going to give her a 2.5.
I quite like the effects. There's a shot of when Stromberg and Agent Triple X, when they leave the thing towards the end and head off to like his hideaway. This toy boat ejects from the back of the ship, and it's clearly just a little tiny boat, and I think it's great. It's so quaint. It's just clearly it's the most apparent miniature ever made. I wonder if
Ringo showed up on the set, you know, so.
Richard.
I'm trying to remember what I gave this when we did the,
I meant to go back and check and I didn't.
I'm going to go along with, Aaron on this one. This is the best of the Roger Moore ones. This is in my top 5, Bond films. I think it does exactly what it's supposed to do. It's the apex of the Moore era. So I'll go 5. If I have bumped it up by half a lamb, I'll just live with the fact that I'm a little inconsistent.
Well, I have bumped mine up by half a lamb because I'm a little inconsistent. Because I gave it 3.5 first time around, and I give it a 4 this time, I think. I think I gave it 3.5. But yeah, this is a 4 for me. It's bumped up a little bit. Maybe just in comparison to some of the other crap ones we've watched since then, I don't know. But I really enjoyed it this time around, and I noticed at the start there's a Jurassic Park reference, like before it was made, when there's a ship is approaching, and they can tell because the glasses of water have ripples in them. And I like to think that Spielberg saw that and thought, yes, I'll include that in my film.
I mean, Spielberg, notably a Bond fan, and has often almost directed one of these movies, so
there
yes.
There we go. That probably is the case. Okay, Moonraker, Rebecca.
I initially gave this one a 3, but I think our discussion has bumped it up to a 3.5 because I did really like Moonraker. I really enjoyed it, and I thought that, you know, the plot's far-fetched, but I don't care if a plot's far-fetched. As long as it sticks to the world in which it's created, then I'm fine with that. And yeah, I did really enjoy Moonraker. So yeah, 3 and 3.5.
Terry?
2.5 on this one. Overblown. A lot of excess, a lot of silliness. You know, that's part of it. You know, at the time, that was what they wanted to do. They want to have some fun in space. After all, what are they going to do with James? Let's put him into space and let's do some fun that way. I'm going to stick with that.
Okay. Richard?
Yeah, I'm genetically predisposed to give any Bond film a minimum of 3, so Moonraker gets a minimum of 3.
Oh, that's a shame. Aaron?
I'm at a 4. I think Moonraker works for what it's trying to do. For any, you know, mild sight gag it has, it delivers on, I think, the spectacle of that time, and I think it does so quite effectively.
And I'm at a 4 as well. It's because I've really enjoyed it. It's a lot of fun. Okay, for your eyes only, Terry, what are you giving it?
Giving it a 3 on this one. A little bit of a cobbled together screenplay. Looked like that Blofeld intro and the whole thing with Margaret Thatcher at the end or something. Like, 2 little endpoints we'll stick in here. Better put the Blofeld in for the purists, and now we'll make up this little plot and put some comedy here at the end. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to go with a 3.
Okay, Richard?
I apparently am the champion of this film on this podcast. I think that the story is solid. I like the fact that they're kind of trying to get back to basics. They do still have some of the silly comedy things, but they pull it back a bit. You don't get the double take from the pigeon. Every time there's a pie in the face, we don't linger over it. You know, it just happens kind of in the background and moves on. I like I said, I think I like Melina. She would be my second favorite of the women in the stories that we looked at in these four. So I'm going to give this a 4.
Okay. Aaron?
I'm at a 2.5 on this one. When I think of, like, if a new Bond movie is coming out, I tend to watch a lot of Bond movies to, like, ramp myself up for it. And this is not one that I, like, put on as far as a must-see list before getting into it. So, like, it just doesn't feel essential to me. So 2.5.
Okay, and Rebecca.
I am also at a 2.5. Boring film is unforgivable to me, especially a boring Bond film. And yeah, just didn't really gel with this one. There were still some good elements. I actually didn't mind the Bond girl in this one. I thought she was all right, but just all right. So 2.5.
Okay, and Richard is contractually obligated to give a Bond film at least a 3. I am contractually obligated to give it at least a 1.5, which is what I'm giving this one. I did not like Fury Eyes Only. I was very bored with it. Sorry, Richard. And I'm doing a letterbox list as we go through this, where I'm ranking the Bond films as we get to them. This is currently number 12 out of 12. This is my least favourite we've watched so far. Just below Thunderball.
If you look at my letterbox list, Moonraker is second from the bottom.
Okay, see?
But it's not at the bottom, so it worked out.
Yeah, no, it isn't.
A lot nearer the top. Okay, well, that's going to do it for our Bond discussion this time. The Lambcast Bond discussion will return in 3 months. But we're going to take a quick break now and come back after these words from a fellow Lamb Podcasting Network show.
So this thing we want to do, what exactly is it?
I think it's a podcast.
I think you just made that word up. Well, anyway, what would it be about? It can be about those things we see in the things, you know, with the pictures and the acting, and sometimes Ryan Gosling.
Oh, you mean films?
Yeah, those. We can talk about those. And Ryan Gosling. And what would we call it?
Women who speak weirdly?
Ladies? Young ladies? All the single ladies? Oh, wait, I know. Oh, chicks with accents.
Yeah, and we could use that song from the Beatles and that movie, Across the Universe.
Cool. Yeah. Listen to the Across the Universe podcast, brought to you by the Chicks with Accents.
Available just about everywhere.
And we are back. As it is a slightly longer show, we are keeping up with the tradition of other Bond franchise shows by skipping the rants, raves, and reviews segment and going straight into a game. And as I host the discussion, Richard is hosting the game. So, Richard, what are we doing?
The game we're going to be playing today is Bond villain lines. In other words, I've got quotes from the Bond films that come from a variety of villains. And you are going to identify the villain who made the quote. I will say that a third of our quotes come from the four films that are featured in today's discussion. I did not take quotes from any films that took place after 1981, so those are excluded. Also, a third of them you have a chance to get a bonus point, because if it is Blofeld, you get a bonus point if you can identify the film that it was in.
Okay.
All right. So we've got the order doesn't really matter. Let's we'll go with Terry, Rebecca, Aaron, and Jay. We'll put Jay at the end again.
Question, right. Real quick: how many Jaws lines are featured in this game?
I'm not telling. That okay. Would be giving it away.
At least one.
Okay. So Terry.
Okay. Yes.
Here's the line. You must excuse me, gentlemen. Not being English, I sometimes find your sense of humor rather difficult to follow.
Oh, merit. Edit.
No.
I'm drawing a blank on that one. Sorry.
Well, that's Hugo Drax. Yeah. Yeah, you don't get the point, Jack.
I know.
I'm shut down. Yeah.
All right, your second quote, Terry. The first one won't kill you, not the second, not even the third, not till you crawl over here and kiss my foot.
Oh, that sounds like something that happened last night. how about Drax?
Nope. That's Red Grant from Russia with Love. All right. Here's your third one. James Bond, you appear with the tedious inevitability of an unloved season.
I love that line.
Oh, Blofeld.
No. That one is Drax.
Yeah.
I have my sheet upside down, you see? That's the problem.
That's a fair point. All right. He seems fit enough. Have him report to me in Istanbul in 24 hours.
Oh, Rosencrab.
There you go. You're on the board.
That would be Lotta Lenya.
Yeah, no extra points for naming the actress.
Okay.
I didn't plan that.
All right.
Next, names is for tombstones.
Oh, God. Goldfinger, Oryk.
Nope, that's Mr. Big in Live and Let Die. All right, this one's fun.
Can
go ahead.
Can you tell the films I've watched? So,
it's okay.
Yeah.
Ah!
Jaws.
Pretty close, almost as silent.
Okay.
It's Odd Job.
Odd Job, yeah.
Odd Job?
The one delivery.
It's his line, yeah. Ah.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Next, you press L, Mr. Bond. The word lobby begins with L.
No, I'm zero on that, guys. Sorry.
All right, that would have been one of your opportunities for a bonus. That was Blofeld. That's in Diamonds Are Forever.
Shit, I've only seen that 7 times, you know, so, yeah.
All right.
Oh, that's
your
a
next one.
One. Yeah.
Please signal your acceptance of our terms by arranging for Big Ben to strike 7 times at 6 p.m. tomorrow.
Shit. Drax on that.
That is not correct. Drax wasn't interested in any deal. That was Blofeld in Thunderball.
Okay, that's...
All right.
Well, I'm getting crushed in this, aren't I?
That happens.
Yes.
All right, number 9. The English don't consider it sporting to kill in cold blood, do they?
Goldfinger.
That is Scaramanga.
Scaramanga? You have to do it with a deeper accent.
I don't do vocal impressions. It's not a good idea.
Very English stuff.
All right, and your last one, 12 seconds. One of these days we must invent a faster working venom.
Piss, I think I just watched this one. 12 seconds, venom. It's not here, guys, sorry.
All right, well, that would have been another opportunity for 2 points. That's Blofeld in From Russia with Love.
Oh, God, I'm miserable on this.
Well, you got a point. At least
you're on the board.
You didn't get nil. So
no.
That's fine. All right.
Rebecca's next. Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't worry yourself, Terry. Yeah.
I'm miserable on this. You know.
Yeah, we all know that Aaron's going to win, so it's fine.
I don't know. The lines, then we'll see.
Yeah.
Okay. Rebecca, your first one.
Okay.
I must arrange to separate my gold from the late Mr. Soto.
I mean, I'm going to guess Goldfinger.
You get a point.
Okay, that's right. Good.
Next, give him his cigarettes. It won't be the nicotine that kills you, Mr. Bond.
I don't know, so I'm going to go with Blofeld.
Blofeld, you get a point for that, and you get another point if you can tell me which Bond film it was in.
Okay, I'm going to guess You Only Live Twice.
You get the bonus point. Right. That is correct.
Okay, cool.
All right. Let his death be a particularly unpleasant and humiliating one.
I don't know. So I'm going to go with Blofeld again.
All right. Well, you get a point for Blofeld.
It's a good strategy if you don't know against Blofeld.
Okay, so let's have a guess. Diamonds Are Forever.
That is not it. It is from Russia with Love. But you did get 1 point.
Cool.
All right. Yeah, when in doubt, Blofeld's the right guess.
Yep.
All right. For me, this is all the world. There is beauty, there is ugliness, and there is death.
Oh, I can, like, see it as well. I'm toying between a couple. I'm gonna get it wrong. So I'm gonna go with... Oh, I can friggin' see it. Stromberg, I don't know.
See, you are wrong.
Okay.
That you were going to get it wrong. That is Stromberg. You get the point.
Yeah. Something to do with the sharks. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Whatever.
All right, next. Unfortunately, I misjudged you, Mr. Bond. You're just a stupid policeman whose luck has run out.
Blofeld?
That is not Blofeld.
Okay, that's fine.
That's Dr. No.
Okay.
Extortion is my business. Go think it over, gentlemen. I'm busy.
I don't know that one. So, Blofeld.
It is Blofeld.
Okay. let's have a guess at... Diamonds Are Forever?
No, that's You Only Live Twice Again.
Okay, cool.
All right.
Still not bad.
No, you're doing great. You're doing great. Jay will have a total at the end. He's much better at the math.
I'm tallying, don't worry.
Today's civilization as we know it is corrupt and decadent. Inevitably, it will destroy itself. I'm merely accelerating the process.
Ooh, well, that can be only one of two. I'm assuming, but I can't remember which one it was, and I've not said his name yet, so I'm going to go with Drax.
And it is the other one, Stromberg.
Okay, oh well, there we go.
And it is Blofeld.
Curious how everyone who touches those diamonds seems to die.
I'm going to go with Blofeld?
No, these are henchmen.
I don't know any of the names of henchmen.
It's Winter Kid. I think it's Mr. Wint, but I could be wrong.
That's fine.
All right. Look after Mr. Bond. See that some harm comes to him.
Drax?
That is Drax.
Oh, okay, cool.
You score a point.
Yes. Good stuff.
All right. And your last one. You're quite right, Mr. Bond. You are worth more to me alive.
Oh, no. Actually, I was initially excited, but then I realized I don't know the answer. But I'm going to guess Goldfinger.
See, that's a good guess, because that's correct.
Oh, good.
Very good. All right, Aaron, you ready?
Let's do this.
All right. I like a girl in a bikini, no concealed weapons.
Scaramanga.
That is correct. That's a Dom Perignon 55. It would be a pity to break it.
That's a good line. Blofeld.
No, it's Dr. No.
Yeah, I thought it was a Connery one for sure. I couldn't tell.
I've taught you to love chickens, to love their flesh, their voice.
Oh, okay.
Chickens. Blofeld.
That is Blofeld.
Yep.
You want to go for the next, the bonus point?
Yeah, I'm going to say, You Only Live Twice.
No, that's on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
He cures the woman who doesn't like chicken.
Yeah. The ballers.
All right. Observe, Mr. Bond, the instruments of Armageddon.
That's going to be Drax.
Ah, the wrong one. That's Stromberg.
Yep.
You better fasten your safety belt.
Fasten your safety belt. Blofeld.
That's Fiona in Thunderball.
Thunderball, okay.
All right. Making mud pies, 007.
Mud pies? I don't know. Kananga.
You forgot the win in doubt rule. That's Blofeld.
It is Blofeld.
Diamonds are forever.
Okay.
Merry Christmas, 007.
Is there one set at Christmas that I'm not thinking of?
Yes, there is.
I don't know. We haven't heard from this one. Is it the Fear Eyes Only guy? What's his name? Chris Testos?
No, it is not. It's Blofeld.
Yeah.
Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah, it was Blofeld for a Christmas movie of the month once.
Yeah.
Choose your next witticism carefully, Mr. Bond. It may be your last.
Goldfinger?
That's correct. Look after Mr. Bond. See that some harm comes to him.
Drax.
There you go. And you're very fortunate to have been chosen for such a simple, delightful duty. A real labor of love, as they say.
Blofeld.
No, that's Rosa Klebb.
Ah, okay. Second to Blofeld.
All right, Jay, you ready?
How many did I get?
Yeah, you got 4.
All right.
How many did I get?
Rebecca got Rebecca's 8.
Oh.
Rebecca's in the lead.
Terry got 1.
I thought it was golf.
No, Rebecca's going to remain in the lead, but I am ready.
Such a pity. All that time and energy wasted simply to provide you with one mock heroic moment.
Blofeld.
It is Blofeld.
Okay. From Russia with Love?
No, it's Diamonds Are Forever.
Okay.
Myself and the phone company will be the only two going monopolies in this nation for years to come.
Oh, Goldfinger?
No.
No.
That's Kananga in Live and Let Die.
Oh, of course it is.
Well, if we destroy Kansas, the world may not hear about it for years.
Oh, shoot. Lager?
It is not. It is Blofeld.
Oh, damn it.
Diamonds Are Forever. All right. If you don't get this one, we'll just have to yell at you a little bit.
Okay.
East, west, just points on the compass, each as stupid as the other.
Get ready to yell at me. One more time?
East, west, just points on the compass, each as stupid as the other.
I mean, I feel like it's not going to be Blofeld, because you gave me that intro for it.
It's not Blofeld. Okay, I'll give you that.
Goldfinger!
No, it's Dr. No.
Okay, that's like one of the Bond films I'm least familiar with.
So. Remember when none of us complained about getting one wrong?
You didn't have that setup of, if you don't get this right, you're done.
I would have known that quote.
Okay. Here we go. No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Goldfinger.
There's your point.
That's the one that should have had the, if you don't get this right, we're going to yell at you.
Yeah.
That's the one I've been waiting for this whole damn game.
Well, and you got it. You see, Mr. Bond, like every great artist, I want to create an indisputable masterpiece once in my lifetime. The death of 007.
Scaramanga.
That is correct. What a pity. Such nice cheeks, too. If only they were brains.
Blofeld?
It is Blofeld.
On Her Majesty's Secret Service?
That is not correct, but you did get the Blofeld point. That's Diamonds Are Forever.
Okay. Oh, it's the plastic surgery. Okay.
No, it's the comment about Tiffany Case.
Oh, yeah, nice cheeks. Yes, not those cheeks. It's the other cheeks.
Right. Yes.
It's about her butt.
Yes, it is. The successful criminal brain is always superior. It has to be.
Kananga.
Unfortunately, no. It's Dr. No.
I like Dr. No less and less. The volume's getting really.
I'm not interested in extortion. I intend to change the face of history.
Kananga.
No.
It's the fun
Stromberg.
It's the fun name to say.
I was going to say, who the hell is Kananga? Which one was he?
Live and Let Die.
Oh, Yaffa, that's why.
Mr. Big.
Mr. Big.
A mistress cannot serve two masters.
Could be a few different ones, but apparently it's only one. I don't think that Christatos has been said at all, so I'm going to say Christatos because I can't win either way.
See, there's a reason you guys think that that movie is so boring, because there's not a single quote from For Your Eyes Only that I used.
It sounds like it's a pretty boring film.
Yeah, there you go. No good quotes, no good dialogue. That's a Scaramanga.
Okay, fair enough.
So Rebecca won, right?
She did. Rebecca won with eight.
Well, you should all be ashamed of yourself, because I only saw these films the first time a couple of weeks ago.
Well, that's it. They're all fresh in your memory.
Perhaps. One would argue.
Well, and it's because you haven't seen some of the other ones, so you haven't got these other...
Yeah!
We all know all the other Bond films by heart, so...
Boy, that makes my memory off, then.
No, well done, Rebecca. And you've won the game, so you get to promote your stuff first. So what have you got to plug that's different from last week?
Okay, so, well, since it's relevant, I do have a Film in Locations post on The Man with the Golden Gun, and a little about the boat tour I did out to James Bond Island. It is actually called James Bond Island now, by the way, so they've just launched on that marketing. Well, what's the word I'm looking for?
I feel like great, like England should be James Bond Island, but fine.
Well, London can be James Bond's city, no, but where the hell else has he been? Scotland, maybe, for a little bit.
Yeah, that's where he's from, goddammit.
There's more to England than London, Jay.
I know, I don't live in London.
But still.
You're on the island.
Houston.
Yes, so yeah, James Bond Island, they've kind of gone with that, essentially, so I've got a post on that. But recently, I've kind of taken a turn over to Spain. I've recently published a post on the Vicky Cristina Barcelona film and locations of Barcelona, and I'm going to continue on a couple of Spain-centered film articles over the next few weeks in almostginger.com. That is my site.
Very nice.
I've got to say.
Aaron, what would you like to promote?
You can... I do a bunch of stuff. I co-host a film podcast with my friend Abe. It is called Out Now with Aaron and Abe. We talk about weekly film releases, and we also put out commentaries every month on other bonus stuff that we're going to do. We just put up a commentary track for The Iron Giant, which is a lot of fun to record. A few weeks ago, we did a Once Upon a Time in Hollywood episode that I was very happy with, among other episodes that I'm always very happy with. So, yeah, that's all on iTunes and everywhere you can find podcasts. I also write film reviews weekly over at weliveentertainment.com. I cover Blu-rays and Criterion releases at whysoblue.com, and I'm on Twitter at AaronsPS4.
Very nice. Terry, what would you like to promote?
Oh, that I know more about Bond than I have a score of one. but I'm currently putting together a book on horror film reviews, anecdotes, and general banter. It's called Screen and Screen Again. It will be available in ebook format soon. It is contents from my blog, Nitrate Visions, with a few extra essays. One of them has to be a rather do with being a Canadian away from the sort of major market of the United States and the UK, and what it's like growing up being a monster kid in the 60s and the influences that it put on me, because it it does change one's point of view. I also do my both my casts or my blogs, Stardust and Shadows, which is classic film, Nitrate Visions, which is the horror film material. I hope to be doing a podcast called Whiskey and Movies, which will be coming out very, very soon. I'm also a co-host of a horror film show called Sinister Inclinations, which deals with independent filmmakers. It's a visual podcast, so it's on YouTube right now. You can find it under Sinister Inclinations, and there's an interview segment as well. That's what I've been doing.
Very nice. Richard.
All right. Well, I have a vlog post to follow up on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, my original blog review. I had a few additional thoughts after seeing it a second time, so there's a video up on my site for you to watch. I saw Blinded by the Light, and there's a post up there about that film, which I would recommend with a couple of reservations. It basically is a remake of Bend It by Beckham. Bend It Like Beckham, but that's okay. If it's derivative, it's got Bruce Springsteen music, and that makes it worthwhile. And then I also have a review up of Good Boys, which is perfectly entertaining. It's not quite as good as you might hope it would be. And the second episode of our podcast, Catching Up, is up. And so if you are a fan of the television show Supernatural, that's the one we're working on right now. So we just completed our discussion of season two.
Nice. With Blinded by the Light, can it be enjoyed by somebody who knows maybe three Bruce Springsteen
Absolutely.
Songs?
Yes, you can. Okay. It's not, that's not a requirement.
Okay. Yes. Jolly.
If you hate how the world's treated you, like, or just the world has been lately, that's just a nice, like, oh yeah, there are good things that happen every now and then. That's what Blinded by the Light is.
Yes, there you go.
Cool. I've got nothing to promote over on my site, Life vs. Film, but I've mentioned my Letterboxd list of James Bond, so feel free to just go and follow me on Letterboxd. It's at jaycluett, J-A-Y, Cluett. You can spell it from this podcast feed somewhere. Over on the LAMP site, Act of the Month is currently Robert Shaw. That will be ending very soon. So next month, Charlie Sheen is our Act of the Month. So if you have any reviews, posts, or podcasts on any Charlie Sheen film, then you can send those to Movie Rob. Director of the Month is Park Chan-wook. So if you have anything on any of the films that he's directed, then you can send those to Tony. Lamb Scores went up on Friday for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It is now our third highest rated film of the year, beaten only by Toy Story 4 and Avengers Endgame. Just knocked John Wick Chapter 3 into fourth place, and it's kicked How to Train Your Dragon 3 off of the list entirely. No one cares about that film anymore. It's gone. And over on the Lamb site, largestmovieblogs.com, you can vote for September's Movie of the Month. There are 10 films in contention. Those 10 films are Not Another Teen Movie, Slingshot Cops, Magnolia, Where the Heart Is, The Matrix, Once Upon a Time in the West, Apocalypse Now, Back to School, The Devils, and The Music Man. Very eclectic list of films there. Go pick one of them. We'll talk about it next month. That's it for this week's show. Next week is a What You Been Watching Lately show. I will not be here because this is my nephew's second birthday party, and apparently I have to go. So the podcast will be being recorded at that time. Hey ho.
That's very big of you.
Yep.
Maybe you can all watch Slingshot Cops together.
It's on Amazon Prime.
So yes.
I don't want to. So Rich will be taking the helm next week. You'll be in safe hands. But as for today's show, I'd like to thank, in no particular order, Aaron Newirth from The Code of Zeke.
Happy to be here. I look forward to hearing about all 100 episodes of Anger Management when you talk about Charlie Sheen.
Also, thank you to Rebecca Sharp from Almost Ginger.
A pleasure as always.
Thank you to Terry Sherwood from Nitro Visions.
thank you very much for having me. Thank you for the audience. And judging by my score, I'm a party of one.
We've had people do worse on games before, don't worry. And finally, thank you to my co-host, Richard Kirkham from Kirkham Movie A Day.
For me, this is all the world. There is beauty, there is ugliness, and there is James Bond.
Strange video.
I think your camera is on, Terry.
Yes, it is.
Okay,
we cameras, right?
You're welcome to have it on if you want. No one else is gonna.
I mean, we'll all judge you.
We will.
Yes.
I already started. There we go.
There you go.
It just makes the conversation that uses up less bandwidth. It's fine.
Yeah.
And no one wants to see me.
I mean, that's something we all agree on.
Yeah. Like,
that was one
Thanks,
of the first
Aaron.
Lamp holes.
Which Lamcast host would you most like to have on their camera during a Skype call? Yeah, I love that.
I voted Todd all the way. He's not here, but
hey, no, Todd. I'm used to doing interviews and stuff like on the cam and everything. But no, you know, c'est la vie. I can be audio guy. Are you getting me okay?
Yeah, sounding absolutely fine. I was a guest on one podcast where I used a camera for the first time and I hated it. I hated every second of it. I didn't like it at all.
Yeah, because you kind of bob like this and everything and go, oh, look, my hair looks like a piece of shit.
You can see I'm clearly reading something right now. This information is not coming off the top of my head.
Andrew is just notably ugly. I mean, it's just an acceptance he has to take in.
I mean, thanks, Aaron. I don't really have you on the show for a reason.
Just being really mean for no reason.
Jeez.
My problem is the exact opposite. I love watching myself do stuff, and I can never pay attention to anything else. I'm like a parrot with a mirror in the cage. You know?
Rebecca, you're less well-versed in Bond, I believe. What's your history with the franchise? Rebecca?
Have we lost Rebecca?
I've just realized that my microphone was on mute.
That's not going to help.
So, here I am.
Okay, Rebecca, what's your history with the Bond films?
Yes, don't really have much of a history.
No, well done, Rebecca. And you've won the game, so you get to promote your stuff first. What have you got to plug?
Oh, what joy!
You've just muted yourself.
Uh-oh. Is that the prize? You get to leave first.
There you are.
Oh, there you are. Okay.
Oh, God, sorry.
So what have you got to plug that's different from last week? Also, thank you to Rebecca Sharp from Almost Ginger. She is muted once again.
Sorry. Sorry, guys.
Go to hell. Go to hell.
You've been listening to The Lamcast. If you've got an idea for a show, any improvements we can make, or you'd like to be a guest on an upcoming episode, find us on Facebook, just search for Lamcast, or on Twitter, @Lamcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com. And please head over to iTunes to leave us a review. The Lamcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.